Tonight on The Download, we reload this week's news with Lauren Cohn and Jeff Cohen. From the indie rockers Sleigh Bells, Derek Miller. And Blues Hall of Famer Eddie the Chief Clearwater. Now, here's your host, a man who took advantage of this beautiful weather to watch Netflix all day, Justin Kaufman.
Come on, that's not true. It was Hulu. It was actually probably just SportsCenter over and over and over. When you get to like the fourth hour of ESPN and they're just doing the same thing, talking about Tom Brady, sleeveless Bill Belichick, you're like, all right, that's I've wasted a day. And that's what it was today. Hey, everybody, it's Justin Kaufman. It's a download here till 11 o'clock tonight. We have an outstanding show lined up. I'm so excited tonight to be back in the chair with the fam. We got Rob Martyr, Roger Badgett tonight, Pete Zimmerman's here. I've been filling in this week with Anna for Ro, who's on vacation. He's back today, so we are back. There's no Blackhawks, no Northwestern basketball. So what do? We reload this week's news. Lauren Cohn and Jeff Cohen from Chicago Tribune going to be in studio. They're regulars here on The Download. They will join us coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, and we'll go over the biggest stories, the winners, the losers, the overreported, the underreported, which stories took you down the rabbit hole, and which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 500 years from this week. 312-981-7200 is our phone number if you would like to play along. Coming up in the 7:30 segment, Gretchen Helfrich is going to be here. If you know that name, she's curating a religious film festival at Facets Multimedia. It's in partnership with the University of Chicago Divinity School. So it's showing different films that have religious, they explore different religious issues. So one of the witness, Harrison Ford's one of the, and what happens is afterwards they have one of the professors from the University of Chicago and Gretchen, they sit down and they talk about the themes that came through. But Gretchen Helfrich, you know that name. She hosted a show called Odyssey here in Chicago at public radio for a long time, national show. And she is going to join us there. I'm so excited to have her. I have a lot of off-air stories to talk with Gretchen. Gretchen, at one point, we lived right near each other because we'd worked together. And she had like a cabriolet. Remember those cars? Like a cabriolet. And she had bought a new car and she didn't know what to do with it. So she kind of gave it to me.
A convertible or?
Yeah, it was a convertible. Yeah. But it was wintertime. And the car lasted maybe 2 weeks until I broke it. We'll talk about the film festival. We will not talk about the cabriolet. That's funny. That's great to have her on the show. First time. I'm excited to have her. Also tonight, Eddie the Chief Clearwater, blues legend, Hall of Famer, Chicago guitar player who has just had a birthday this month, and that was celebrated by certain towns, I think Skokie and Westmont, both declaring Eddie the Chief Clearwater Day on his birthday. He's a huge deal, and he's been playing guitar and blues, Chicago blues, here in town since 1950. So we will talk with him tonight about the Chicago blues, the history, where it was, what the scene was like, about his experience of crossing the color barrier and getting a chance to go play at Kingston Mines up on the north side of Chicago. Most blues musicians at the time, African Americans, played on the south and west sides of Chicago. They weren't allowed to play in clubs in the north side, but Eddie the Chief, because of his style and because of, he could play rock and roll, was given a chance to break the color barrier, and we'll talk to him about that experience. Eddie the Chief Clearwater tonight in the Download. How fun is that? Chicago blues. Gosh, man, I love it. I've seen Eddie the Chief. Chief used to have a restaurant in Wicker Park. That was the best part, to go in there, have some chicken tenders, watch some live blues. Also tonight, the band Sleigh Bells, indie rock band. I love those guys. They, of course, they're just meteoric in their rise. They have become a band that first people are like, really like this. And then just in the last couple of years have started playing all the big festivals, and their latest record is a huge hit. And they're going to be at Metro coming up at the beginning of next week. And we, Derek Miller, one half of Sleigh Bells, will join us tonight. That's a lot of great stuff. Don't you think it's a lot of great stuff? And we got the carryout coming up here. So let's get to it. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martyr and Roger Badish. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We will do the carryout, so stay with us. All right, it's The Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 8 o'clock, we'll reload this week's news. But right now, let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. The president talked unfair trade and that the country was open for business at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Davos. Is that where the lions are from? Oh, that's Savos. Got it. He said no more unfair trade, signaling to the world that the president intends to fulfill campaign promises to use tariffs and taxes to level the playing field with countries who he believes get better deals or better got better deals in the past. And then the press said, despite all that, the U.S. is open for business. Is that that's how you pitch your business? Don't you dare try to rip us off. So who's in? While the prez was convincing, is that the right word? The world to do business with us on a global scale. The U.S. economy got some raw news this week, which is in direct conflict to what the White House has been saying. The economy only grew at 2.6% in the fourth quarter and only 2.4% in Trump's first year. This is on par and in some cases worse than the previous administration. In fairness, nobody would be pointing this out at all if the Trump administration didn't always point out the opposite. That the economy is great, and economy, fake news, no collusion, economy. And again, I want the economy to grow. I'm open to the president's ideas about raising wages, creating jobs, tax cuts, all of that. I want him to succeed. But less circus barking on social media would be okay too, right? You growing the economy doesn't have to always be followed up with why you're better than everybody else. You're like the video blogger who got a bad comment once and then had to upload a 3-hour video talking about how it made you feel. We get it. Stop talking and play that cool Pentatonix cover on your guitar. You're like the Conor McGregor of Twitter. You're the Yasiel Puig of national politics. You are 2018 Flavor Flav. That hurts. The serial stowaway is back and dumber than ever. She got caught again trying to sneak on flights at O'Hare, and she chose an international flight to Heathrow. She made it on the flight, made it all the way to London, but then the dum-dum didn't realize that you got to go through customs on the way off that flight. She was caught and had to, and then we had to read all about it again. She should just say she's a TV reporter trying out new Sweeps Week pieces, right? By sneaking on planes. Worked for that crew in Newark. That'd be better. A transgendered student in Palatine filed suit against the high school there because even though the law and the policy is to let transgendered students use the locker room that they identify with, we already argued this, someone at the school was like, nope, I'm coach, I wear the polyester short shorts here. And the student has been relegated to a private changing area segregated from other students. Again, this has already been established, right? So what's up? Someone just doesn't like the rule? I mean, hey, I don't like stopping at stop signs or having a sign for Sudafed, but I have to. So what's up? Here's a terrible story. Militants in Afghanistan stormed a hotel last weekend and killed 22 people, including 4 Americans. One of the dead is Chicago publicist Glenn Selig. Selig was a well-known publicist and consultant who represented many power players, including former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. I worked with Glenn a few times trying to get the former governor to come on this show or that show or make an appearance at a comedy show I was producing. So this is a terrible story. I searched his name in my email and I found a request that he somewhat entertained to have Blago come out to a Schadenfreude show that I was doing. And he'd be introduced and come up on stage right in front of a packed crowd, and he would hush the crowd and say, I didn't do it. And then the crowd goes wild and he walks off stage shaking hands and he just leaves. It was a 2-minute commitment. I was negotiating a 2-minute commitment. And I told him we could pay them a cut of the door and that there was free food. And you know what? I give Glenn a lot of credit because he entertained it. It didn't happen, but he entertained it. Rest in peace. In weather? Holy hoodie, huh? Put away the winter jackets. Get the cool windbreakers out. 50 degrees plus today. Unreal. And Skilling said yesterday that there's no crazy winter storm behind this, so we don't have to worry about end of days type weather because of it. So enjoy. Go walk in nature. Fire up the grill. Squeegee the tennis courts. It's mini spring. In sports, the Bulls are playing with cool jerseys tonight. They're playing the Lakers. Too bad they're still in the same Bulls, huh? They've taken a step back since the face plant from point guard Chris Dunn. He's been out of the lineup. Is he back? I don't know when he comes back. Maybe after the All-Star break? I don't know. They haven't won. Luckily, it's only been 2 games or so, but they had that New Orleans game the other night and let it slip away. This is where I would single out Zach LaVine for not closing out games, but he walked into the sandwich shop I was in today, and that's super cool. So now he can do no wrong in my eyes. In Philly, did you see, this is when they lost to the 76ers, did you see the video of the mascot messing with Robin Lopez? The Philly mascot took Robin Lopez over to a flip notebook on an easel, and it said, "Congrats, Robin." And then he flipped it, and it said, "You are an NBA All-Star." And it was the night that they were announcing it, so Lopez actually looked around like, "Is this for real? I am?" with a big smile on his face. And then the mascot flipped another page, and it said, "Yeah, an All-Star mascot assistant." And then he pushed him, and he walked away. What? Cold as ice. You can't do that. And then I looked into it, and I did not know this, but Robin Lopez has a history with messing with league mascots. Every time he goes to a different city, he gets in fights with the mascots. He picks them up. There's all this video online. And he's got an ongoing beef with the Philly dog or whatever it is. How is this not common knowledge, right? We'd love Robin Lopez so much more if we knew he messed with mascots. But poor Robin Lopez, man. That's cruel. Philly media loved it. One more week to the Super Bowl so we can get a couple more feel-good pieces and how old Tom Brady is and how sleeveless Bill Belichick looked. I like that former Bear Brandon Marshall said yesterday, the NFL players and coaches should be ashamed of themselves for letting the Patriots win all the time. Agreed. Each time the Patriots win a playoff game, all the rest of the teams in the league should be fined $25,000. Right? I think that would be awesome. Getting closer to March Madness, our Illinois hopefuls, including Northwestern, have to start streaking to the finish line. And I don't mean streaking as in streaking the quad. I mean winning out. Northwestern actually has a weekend off, but starting on Monday, they got Michigan, Wisconsin, Maryland, Michigan State. Woo! They win those games, they might be in business for a run to the tourney. Right now, Loyola's playing big. They've won six in a row and sit atop the standings in the Missouri Valley Conference. They win their tournament, they are an automatic bid. That'd be cool. There we go. Little Rogers Park. Do they consider themselves a downtown? Because they got a downtown campus, too. Is Rogers Park? All right. Blackhawks won last night, picked up 2 points on a few teams. Right now, they're 4 points back in the final playoff spot with four or five teams in front of them. They hold their destiny in their hands because they have plenty of head-to-heads coming up with those teams in February and March. So, yes, not a great first half for the Hawks, but if they right the ship and play over 500 down the stretch, they get in. And we saw last year, that's all you got to do. The Predators were the 8 seed. The Predators. Patrick Kane repping the Hawks this weekend at the NHL All-Star Game. And still no word on what the Cubs are doing with Yu Darvish, possibly Jake Arrieta. The Brew Crew are not waiting around, though. They lit the stove this week, acquired Lorenzo Cain from Kansas City. Cubs should have got him. That would have been good. And Christian Yelich from the Marlins. Two All-Star caliber outfields just came to the NL Central. Might want to lock down a potential Cy Young pitcher, maybe, to fend that off. But Brewers are quickly becoming the new Cardinals, and the old Cardinals will probably be good too. Reds and Pirates, meh. The Sox have their convention this weekend. It'll be exciting to see all the kids there to enjoy the festivities. Oh, and the young fans too. Today's the 33rd anniversary of the 85 Super Bowl. It's also the 23rd anniversary of getting a top draft pick. And the 13th. And the 3rd. And the 2nd. And this year. And we're caught up. But hey, fun to reminisce, right? I mean, remember how they beat that lowly nobody team, the Patriots? I mean, what happened after that? What have they done since? Yeah. And finally tonight, the famed doomsday clock at the University of Chicago has moved closer to midnight. Yep, after the events of last year, month, day, hour. I don't know. The scientists have moved us only 2 minutes till the end. That means the clock is closer to ever to the 12 midnight doomsday. And what does that mean? That means we're closer to dying. Well, could they at least wait till the reboot of Roseanne, right? I just want to see if it holds up. That's it. That's the carryout for January 26, 2018. It's so nice out that we've plugged the lemonade machine back in for the weekend. And lucky for us, there's still some lemonade in it. Don't worry, I'm sure it's safe. Lemonade's like wine, right? Ages? No? Well, it's only a dollar. All right, coming up, Gretchen Helfrich is going to join us, talk about her film festival at Facets, exploring religious themes. And then at 8 o'clock, we'll reload this week's news. And after that, Eddie the Chief Clearwater, and the indie rocker Sleigh Bells. It's a full show tonight, so stay with us here on 720 WGN. Rob Martier, how are you, buddy?
How are you doing? I'm doing well, thanks.
It's good. I mean, I feel like we're back. It's fam. We're back.
I missed you guys.
I know. I missed you
and
too,
Pete's. You know? Some bad Blackhawks hockey. Yeah, they won last night, but, you know.
Yeah, they're going to, but they'll be back, right? You're a hockey guy. You're a resident hockey guy.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some loose ends they need to tie up, but I think they're on it. I hope.
very confident.
That's about as concise as an analysis as I can give you right now.
I enjoy the confidence that's exuding out of you, Mr. Martier. Thanks, Rob. Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up 8 o'clock, Lauren Cohn and Jeff Cohen are going to join us. We're going to reload this week's news, 312-981-7200. I also got incentive if you want to join, because we're probably just going to do we're going to give away tickets tonight to Potted Potter, which is the Harry Potter parody, which I saw, which was pretty good, over at the Water Tower place. And they're giving away one pair of tickets. So we'll do that coming up during reload somewhere. Maybe it'll be guess what color tie Trump was wearing in Davos. Something like that. I'll figure out the question as we go. Or we'll just say the 10th caller. I don't know. We'll figure it out when we get there. Also, Eddie the Chief Clearwater coming up a little bit later. And the band Sleigh Bells. Starting this Sunday and running through the week will be the Religion in the Frame Film Festival. It's a festival that features films that explore religious ideas, themes, and conflicts across a diverse array of backgrounds. Such films such as Witness with Harrison Ford, one of my favorites, A Serious Man by the Coen Brothers starring Michael Stuhlbarg, who was just on this program, and Groundhog Day, just to name a few of the films featured. The festival is being put on by the University of Chicago Divinity School and Facets Multimedia, where all the films will be screened. And the best part, after each screening, a scholar from the university will talk with a moderator and the audience afterwards. And that moderator and the curator of the festival is in studio tonight, Gretchen Helfrich. Gretchen's a lawyer in town. She sits on the boards, both at Facets and the Martin Center Advisory Board at the University of Chicago. But that's not how you know her name. Gretchen hosted a national radio show out of Chicago called Odyssey for a number of years. It aired on public radio all over the country and here on 91.5 FM. Gretchen Helfrich with me tonight. It's a reunion of sorts. Good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you, Justin.
It's a pleasure. When I saw you attached to this and that this film festival is coming, we jumped at the opportunity to get back on the microphone. We've worked together a long time.
We have. Do you remember the time I left you behind at dinner one time, drove off, paid no attention to the fact that you hadn't gotten into the car?
That is true. That's a good story.
It just popped in my head now.
Wow, that's bringing. I think I need to bring that up in therapy.
You were so angry.
It was one of those. Gretchen, we were talking, and I was waiting for the door to get open, and she just took off. The car took off. Anyway, let's talk about the film festival. You've always had, you've always been a film buff, and you've always been around this. Talk about where Religion in the Frame comes from.
Well, yeah, it's true. I have always been a film buff and did a lot of film on Odyssey and have worked also with Miloš Stalek, who's the executive director of Facets, for years. In fact, my very first job in radio was producing his movie reviews for Jerome McDonald and WBEZ. So, that's how I got involved with Facets. And then I've also been involved with the Marty Center for a long time. And coming up next Saturday is the 20th anniversary of the Marty Center and the 90th birthday of Martin Marty,
wow,
who is just an amazing guy. And they were starting to think about how to celebrate those events. And I said, I think I have an idea. So I checked with my Facets peeps and I checked with my Martin Marty peeps and said, how about if I did a little film series? And they said, yippee. We think that'd be great. And especially if you do it and do the work. No, I'm just kidding. They're really supportive and really helpful. But it just seemed like such a great mix and such a perfect way to fulfill the mission of both organizations, which are both pretty terrific organizations, in my opinion.
Well, obviously the film, we'll talk about the films that are chosen. I mentioned a couple of them in the intro, but, talk about what you're trying to get at with these films, featuring these films, each one each night from Sunday to Friday.
Well, so what I really wanted to do was get a collection of films. I wanted to do two things. I wanted to get films that would motivate folks at the Divinity School to talk. In other words, films that they felt they had something to say, about. Is that a sentence? Whatever.
Yeah, no, it's...
films that illustrated themes they worked on or that maybe they used in their work. So that was one thing that I really wanted to do. And then I also wanted it to be a mix of ways of thinking about religion in film. Some of the films, like the opening film on Sunday is Elmer Gantry, which is a really great 1960 Burt Lancaster movie. And it's pretty, clearly about religion, no question about it, in a certain way. But then you have a movie like Groundhog Day, which is not at all about religion on the surface.
Right.
But actually...
But it has this, a lot of the themes that religion...
It sort of illustrates an idea in Buddhism that we're going to be talking about rebirth into suffering and what it takes to get out of that cycle and those sorts of things. So...
Was it important for you to be diverse in the kind of religions that you talked about, that it wasn't just American religions or one type of Christian religion? Was it important to find films that represented all, or yeah, at least as much as you could in 6 days?
Yeah, as much as you could in 6 days. There's the...
That's the tagline?
That's the tagline.
As much religion fit into 6 days.
Yeah. And it turns out it's hard to fit all the religions into 6 days. And I didn't want it to be like, today's film, Islam. You know, but that's kind of, there's a little bit of that going on. We've got a film on Friday called The Lizard, which is an Iranian film about a guy who escapes from jail by disguising himself as a cleric. In a society run by clerics, that's an interesting move. It's not a documentary. Yeah, I don't right. know. It's not like he did something daring, but it's a comedy, and it's in addition to being funny and being kind of a poking fun at the theocracy in Iran, it's also engages with ideas within Islam about what it means to be a good person and what it means to be good on the inside versus good on the outside, and you know, doing things. Appearances versus reality and questions like that that are very significant within Islam. So we've got that. We've got A Serious Man on Wednesday, which has a lot of ideas about God and about suffering that come out of Jewish tradition. It's really overtly about Judaism. I mean, that's not even, it's all on the table right there. So yeah, we did our best. We didn't get everything in there. We have one movie called Kumare, which everybody thinks is a movie about Hinduism, but it's really not. It's about a guy who pretends to be an Indian holy man. Have you seen it? Do you know?
I have not.
Movie?
No.
It was really a big hit at South by Southwest in 2011 or 12. I forget. But this guy, he does like a Borat thing where he decides he's going to pretend to be a holy man and go out and try to get followers. And he does. He dresses, you know, wraps himself up in orange robes and starts talking like, as he puts it, at some point in the movie, he says, I just started to talk like my grandmother, you know, in this Indian accent that I just did so well. And goes out and starts talking to people and wins them over. And then you've got, then all of a sudden, here's this guy who's pretending and he's got all these followers.
Yeah, it's
really,
that's
it's weird. And it's really, parts of it are quite uncomfortable because you know, and they don't.
That's good. Gretchen Helfrich, my guest, she's the curator and she's going to be the moderator of the conversations after the film shown in Religion in the Frame, the film festival at Facets. I guess that's considered Lincoln Park, Lakeview, the area at Ashland and Fullerton.
It's Facets Land. That's just what it's called.
It's where the Walgreens is at, right?
Right
across from the Walgreens is at.
Across from the Walgreens.
Gretchen Helfrich with me. We'll talk more about the festival coming up. Stay with us. It's a download here, 720 WGN. Gretchen Helfrich, my guest, the curator and moderator, longtime broadcaster and lawyer. She is putting on the Religion in the Frame Film Festival, which will be at Facets Multimedia. It is a collaboration between the University of Chicago Divinity School and Facets Multimedia, specifically the Martin Center, as we were talking about. Martin Marty Center. Martin Marty, a longtime professor at the University of Chicago, turning 90 years old in a week. Talk about that center, because that's something that is really about his contributions, his accomplishments at the University of Chicago.
Well, Martin Marty is a just incredibly impressive scholar of primarily American religion. But, you know, he's published so many things that now he's basically a scholar of everything. But his main thing is American Protestantism. And the center that was named for him when he was only 70...
that's a feat, though. I mean, most of the time centers are named after you die.
Well, most of the time you don't get a center named after you. I don't have one.
True.
Maybe you do, Justin.
Oh man, I wish I had a center.
The Justin Kaufman
Darn
Center
it.
For something
yeah,
something
for something something. I'll take it.
So the center is dedicated to promoting public dialogue about religion, because you know you've got these divinity schools that have people doing just incredibly interesting research about religion, both contemporary religion, historical religion, all kinds of things. But you know, we live in a world where religion is a dominant theme in a lot of ways. You see it all the time, but in our politics, in our public life. But in addition to that, you know, people personally, lots of people are on religious journeys or, you know, thinking about the big questions that religion addresses. And so the Marty Center is designed to bring the work from the university out into the public. So this film series is a really great opportunity to do that and to engage with a different public.
I was
going to
say, is the festival, it obviously shows, we talked about the films that are going to be in it, but it's really, as you just mentioned, if it's about public discourse and what you guys are doing after by bringing the scholars out to talk to the audience who just saw the film, you can make an argument it's more about that than it is about the films.
Well, yeah. I mean, for both organizations, both for the Martin Marty Center and Facets, you know, it's about creating conversations and creating, I know it sounds corny, but creating community, but creating dialogue and, you know, getting people to have different kinds of experiences with strangers, frankly, is a good way of putting it. So this is a terrific opportunity to have a very public event. You know, movie is a really public event. There's a public audience. People don't know each other. They just gather together. And then you get to have this conversation afterwards that both allows you to figure out a little more what you got out of the movie. Hopefully, we'll be able to give the audience like a deeper understanding of what it was they saw or something about the film. I mean, that's the goal. And just make the experience better all around.
Picking, and people are texting in as well, other movies that have to do with religion, but picking six movies, of course, there's a lot of religious-themed films throughout history. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds and thousands of films because a good film is going to get at the themes that connect human beings and human society, and a lot of that has to do with religion.
Yeah, I think you can find religious themes in most movies that are interesting. But even setting aside the movies that are not overtly religious, just the movies that are straightforwardly engaging with religious questions. You can't, when I started this, I thought, let me see what's out there. And then I went, oh my God, what are we going to do? I know. I was like, we're totally going to shortchange. And of course, everybody will have their, why don't you include this? Why don't you include, because we had six nights. That's why. Because you can't do it all in six nights, for God's sake.
Well, speaking of, I mean, this is for God's sake, which is good. But there is, I mean, you see that the themes of religion, they play out in a way that we see in our news all the time. It's politicized to death. I mean, there's so much of it, right? But when you think about art and specifically about film, you're right in the way that a lot of the films that have really caught our attention or have worldwide prestige, they always surround religious themes and identities, or at least questioning what brings us all together. So there is something to be said about the fact that a religious film festival could probably go on in perpetuity.
It could go on in perpetuity. It could at least go on for 4 years. 4 solid years, every single night, I think, without missing a beat.
Did you go into this saying, okay, I have to have this film? Was there one of the six that you're like, all right, I got an idea for a festival, and it's got to have this film?
There was Elmer Gantry. Was the one, because I really, really wanted to talk to Martin Marty about it afterwards. I mean, it's a great film on its own, and whether you care about the religion that's in it, and it's a skewering, I think it's fair to say, of a certain type of American Protestantism. But I'm not, for me, that's not the interesting thing. What's interesting about it is that there's so much in it that illustrates what makes American religious experience, and especially Protestantism, which has been the dominant religion right in the country. What makes the American Protestant experience unique, or maybe that's too strong, but quite different from other places? You know, Martin likes to say that the United States is the only country that has the concept of getting religion. You know, I think that's changing now, but for a long time, other countries were like, well, you just have it. Like, it's just there. You're born with it, or you live in a certain place, or whatever. And this idea that you'd go into a tent and be saved was really an American thing.
Interesting.
And there's so many things like that about the entrepreneurial spirit of American religion. It's all on display in Elmer Gantry in the movie. Plus, there's Burt Lancaster, who's just like such a peculiar actor. There's something about him that's like, really? Are you a real person? I don't know. He cracks me up.
The festival is called Religion in the Frame. It's at Facets Multimedia right there at Fullerton and Ashland. Mila Stelik, great place to see film. Look it up. The Facets Multimedia, and it will be a film festival that starts Sunday, runs through Friday. It's showing 6 films, and afterwards there will be discussions with scholars from the University of Chicago Divinity School. Gretchen Helfrich is the moderator of those discussions and also the curator of this film festival, and also a friend. Good to see you.
Great to see you.
I feel like it's been way too long.
It's been a really long time.
And with the algorithms on Facebook, I don't see your stuff enough. I just don't see your stuff.
I'll work on my algorithms.
Yeah, I'm gonna send something to Facebook.
I'm gonna tag you in everything,
thank you.
Regardless of what it is.
Thank you. Great to see you, and good luck with the festival.
To see you. Thanks.
Thanks, Rob. It's the download here, 720 WGN. It's time to reload the news. Biggest stories, winners, losers, overreported, underreported. What story took you down the rabbit hole, and which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from this week? Lots to choose from, and we've got the choosers in studio. Lauren Cohn, a longtime Chicago journalist, both radio, television. Lauren, good to see you.
Good to be here.
And Jeff Cohen, an investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Good to see you, Jeff.
Hello, sir.
Regulars here to the Reload segment. 312-981-7200 if you'd like to call in and give us your choices for winners, losers, biggest story, all that jazz. We'll start tonight with biggest stories. This was a week where there was a lot of big stories. And it really came down to two big ones, maybe three, because what kills me is that the government shutdown was this week. If you think about it, that was Saturday that happened, Friday into Saturday, and it was resolved on Monday. That counts as this week. That blows my mind.
That was sort of a win for Republicans, right?
Because
they didn't have a government shutdown for 24 hours.
Right, exactly. But it always blows my mind when you get to Friday. Like, what are we going to talk about? What about that ancient thing from 6 months ago? Oh, no, that was Monday.
Yeah, the women's marches were this week.
The women's march was, all those stories are big stories, but the two that really came on this week, and we'll talk about now, the Russia investigation, of course. But first, let's start with Larry Nassar, the sentencing, and USA Gymnastics, Michigan State University. That's my choice, all of our choices, for biggest story of the week.
You know, it was so heartbreaking to listen to all the girls and women that came forward, and, you know, more than 100.
And 156.
Just unbelievable. I mean, it was heart-wrenching, and, you know, right on with the judge, you know, you're never going to be out of a jail cell again. But the fact that this was able to go on for so long, and, you know, you see the board members that, you know, stepped down today, and anyone involved in that should face criminal charges. They really should.
If there is, I mean, that's going to be the issue. If there's any evidence that they covered up or didn't act.
Well, there are resignations at Michigan State as well in the past couple of days with, you know, allegations that questions were raised there, you know, back into the 90s.
It's amazing to me that kind of thing can happen in 2018. And I was listening to a lawyer talk about it. And their thought was, listen, this is a textbook case of caring more about the integrity, or not even the integrity, but the health and profitability of a sport than the athletes that play that sport.
And some of these, you know, young girls came forward, you know, parents were told, and yet nothing was done to protect these girls. And then you have someone like Ali Riesman who comes out, but she's an Olympian, and it kind of shows you, like, it took the Me Too movement had to be Hollywood, people who had made it, because obviously it was going on. We knew it's going on in corporations everywhere. And
right.
Until you have people who have money behind them or power behind them where they can't be touched is when they can come out and speak. It's when you don't that you feel like you can't say anything.
It's amazing.
And,
yeah.
You know, also, it was a bit of a win for investigative journalism. The Indy Star is getting a lot of credit now for breaking that
Absolutely,
story.
Right.
The prosecutor in the hearing actually even credited, you know, newspaper reporting for helping to push that over. So,
side stories in this, of course, Michigan State and USA Gymnastics. I mean, they're going to do everything they can to distance themselves. They want the Olympic Committee wants resignations. They got it today. Michigan State wants resignations. They got it. But that's not good enough. We already saw in the scandals that were at Penn State that it was resignations and people went to jail and there were billions, almost billions of dollars in fines. And so it feels like Michigan State is teetering close and may have already crossed over into Penn State territory.
It's tarnished their image. There's no question about it. They better get some pretty good PR going. It's and there's probably going to be so many more stories and levels that we come out and hear about things. This has legs. This has legs, for sure.
The other story that came out, and you talked about the judge, but the judge became, with the really, I thought, unbelievable line where it says, I just signed your death warrant. Is that what she said?
Yeah.
That's crazy for a judge to say. But, I mean, obviously, and I've heard some people say that they thought she was grandstanding, that she knew the cameras were on her. But that was intense what she was saying in the courtroom.
Yeah, as a longtime reporter's covered a lot of court hearings. That kind of goes above and beyond, I think, anything that I heard in my years in court. And, you know, you have to be careful as a judge, too, you know, creating appeal issues. You know, if he decides to appeal the sentence as too harsh, you know, that becomes Exhibit A, that kind of a comment.
Yeah, and then, but also, she also became a rallying cry with one of the statements that she made, where she said, get it out now in this sentence hearing, and don't let it stay with you. Go do amazing things. That was her message to the girls and the women that were telling their stories. So she really became almost a folk hero, but she's a judge.
Right. I mean, some could call it unprofessional. And I think we see more of these theatrics in courtrooms today than we ever did before. And I think because it was so emotional, I mean, think about it, if you're the judge or anyone in that courtroom listening to the emotions of these young women, you can't help yourself. We know that's not her role. But I also think that, you know, for these young girls, Nassar's going to jail, but you know, their lives are changed forever.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't get erased just because he goes to prison.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this story, as you said, has legs, and it will be probably the biggest story for a couple weeks to come. Jeff, let's talk about the other big story, the Russia investigation, and really surrounding the fight between the president, Donald Trump, and the FBI. Secret texts or secret societies and lost texts and all this happened this week. It really put a spotlight. And now the latest news that the president asked his counsel if he could fire Robert Mueller, really playing into this continuing idea that the president and the administration is guilty of obstruction of justice.
Yeah, I think unlike when, you know, Manafort was indicted and things like that that we've seen recently, this was a week where it kind of moved forward in smaller pieces. But all of it, you know, sort of suggested that there's continued momentum there. I mean, this week we had Donald Trump saying that he would, you know, be willing to testify under oath in the Mueller investigation. You know, whether how truthful that is, it's one thing to just say it.
I mean, I'm a cool president. I'm cool. My lawyers, they may not let me, but I'm cool. I'm a cool guy.
I'll do it. I'll do it.
I'll do anything. Sure. But my lawyers, I'm not sure. I mean, that's so ridiculous.
Let's pull up a chair right now. Right. And you had news that Jeff Sessions has been interviewed in recent weeks. And then, of course, just in the last 24 hours or so, news broke that Trump in June actually made some attempt to fire Mueller, and the White House counsel indicated he would quit if that occurred, and that it didn't happen. So you have to remember last summer how much of the talk centered on whether Trump might actually try to pull that. And, you know, all of his spokespeople are out there saying no,
he would never do that. And now the rumor is that he did.
Yeah, of course.
All right, Lauren. The question I have is, I mean, I'm trying to like keep partisan views out of this, because there's a lot of both sides are spinning. There's a memo that Devin Nunes has. There's texts in the FBI, political bias. But I mean, are we in Watergate territory? I keep seeing parallels to how that all kind of played out before all of the convictions, arrests, and resignations came down.
Well, we haven't heard of there yet. I mean, we're waiting to see, is this obstruction of justice? Is this collusion? How is it going to be? How are you going to spin it? First of all, this is a guy. We have to remember, when we think of presidents, you have to think of this president's personality. This is a guy who made a career on television of telling people, you're fired.
Right.
So it's very possible you've got a president who's walking around going, can I fire him? Should I fire him? We don't know. We don't know what happened. And if McGahn becomes the hero here because he said, wait a minute, the optics are going to be really bad after what happened with Comey if you fire him, right? So Trump maybe nodded his head and said, okay, I can't fire him. I mean, we don't know. And so what's the there?
Right.
And that's what we're waiting to find.
And
I think
that seems
so much,
plausible. What you just said is plausible. It's plausible. But I think a lot of the American people, at least people on the left, The concern is that the president doesn't know how to do his job. And what I mean is, there's a lot of policy procedures and laws and regulations that go along with being the president of the United States, and he flaunts it. He doesn't care. He flips his nose to it. He just is like, could I fire this guy? And it's obstruction of justice.
Yeah, and that's going to be part of the question, especially, you know, through the Comey firing and all the other issues, is how much is him being Trump and just talking out loud and not thinking things through, number one, and when does that cross into provable obstruction? And I think the other issue, we were talking about this before we came on, is a lot of the speculation is that Mueller, even if he finds for obstruction, will probably follow the Ken Starr model, won't indict, and will just take his findings to Congress. And then what happens? I mean, it's up to the Senate to actually remove him by a margin that they're never going to have in terms of Republican versus Democrats. So we could get to the end of this have a finding and still not have anything.
It's going to play out for politics. It's going to play out for the midterms, which Jeff and I were already talking about. So you have to look at it as, was there collusion, obstruction of justice? Is President Trump going to say, hey, I was under attack, I was just fighting back, which he's done before? And we won't know. And so this is going to go on and on and on. And you know, we in the media, we read and we go through all of this. I don't know that the general public is so well versed on the Russia story. Yeah. You know, way back when it was sexy, when you know there was all this intrigue and we were trying to figure this out. And now it's been a year and of him as the president. So
I read a great story today, and I forgot who did it. It might have been Slate. I can't remember. Just talking about, you get to the point where what's a coincidence and what is actually. Not collusion, but this idea that one of the reasons that President Nixon went down in Watergate was because he had instructed his staff to lie, and they got that on tape, and it was Nixon on tape, and then the at that time the special prosecutor who was sympathetic to Nixon was actually they thought was on his side. Heard that tape and said, what? That's egregious. You can't do that. And that's what started it. And so the question that still is at the heart here is, did the president in any form actually instruct the people who are all coming out and either pleading or possibly having their stories unchecked, have they been told to lie?
And remember, this is a guy without a filter. This is a guy who is not, you know, a polished politician who knows, he just says what's on his mind at the time, or he tweets about it, and sometimes he falls back. But, you know, we just don't know.
No. Lauren Cohn, Jeff Cohn in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll start the winners and losers. Sound good? It's the Reload on the Download. Stay with us. It's Download here, 720 WGN. Lauren Cohn, Jeff Cohn in studio. We are reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. If you want to jump in on what we're talking about, the biggest stories of the week, we're moving on to the winners and losers now. Jeff, why don't we start with you? You had in the winners category, both had in the winners category, the women's marches. And this was something that came out, the crowds, this was on Saturday, this counts as this week, and the crowds were bigger than the year before. This was a big moment for voters to hit the streets to celebrate or protest the one-year anniversary of Trump.
Yeah, it was huge crowds. I mean, you rarely see a movement like that. So, you know, kudos to all the women that came out there, whether they were walking because they were anti-Trump or in support of Me Too. It was just a statement that, you know, and I think what all this has done, whatever side of the politics you're on when it comes to the president, it says that I think more people are engaged in the process. More people may run for office, it's inspiring women to maybe run for office or have a bigger voice or maybe more people to go to the polls just to see something that big.
Yeah.
And I think whatever, you know, political side people fall on and whatever you think of the, you know, the resist movement, and the last weekend proved that it's definitely still there.
Right.
It's not like a year has, you know, pushed any of the momentum back from that. And I think that just having that kind of a public face on it again, I think just really stresses to people all the way up to the president that there's a real groundswell of opposition to a lot of what he's doing.
It is right now considered to be opposition. Does the movement, as it grows and the crowds get bigger each time they do it, does it affect policy change? Does it start to soften the president's view on some of the issues that are being protested?
Well, I mean, part of the whole Me Too movement was taking a look at what's in the Oval Office and, you know, accusing the president of, you know, being a sexual harasser as well and saying inappropriate comments. You know, why on the tape did Billy Bush lose his job? But, you know, President Trump went all the way to the Oval Office. And so I think that was part of the statement that was being made there's always things, how you feel about immigration or how you feel about healthcare, how you feel about the economy. But I think the Me Too movement that has gone, you know, after Harvey Weinstein and Roger Ailes, sort of pushed more women into the streets and saying, well, what about the Oval Office? And I think that is that going to change policy or change anything in Washington? Doubtful.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think that, you know, it's pretty widely known that this is the guy that was elected. He hasn't changed a whole lot in the last year or so. Yeah. So I think that that, and even among, you know, you would look at maybe his evangelical base and think, well, when does things like Stormy Daniels start to wear him down? And there's not really much of a sign of that either. Is, you know, their leadership in that group this week saying they were giving him a mulligan on that one, and really on a lot in his personal life, just because they really only care about the black and white of, you know, what he can do for them in terms of nominating Supreme Court justices that align with their views and that sort of thing. They really only care about that
the social
kind of
issues,
meets the,
right?
Meets the road versus his own personal shortcomings.
It's really hard not to. I mean, when you say that's perfect. I mean, the hypocrisy of all politics, both sides, to think that the social uproar over Monica Lewinsky and President Clinton, and to where we're at now, and now it's not a social uproar because that, you know, we want to get our. I mean, well, you sound like they you really could put a costume and you would do a game show. Is it a Republican or a Democrat?
I think the whole country has shifted, and I think Trump has helped to shift it. And the line that they always use is that we did not elect him pastor of the United States of America.
Oh, interesting.
And so they really only care about the policy.
Wow. All right. The other winner, before we take a break and continue with the reload, Tammy Duckworth. Tammy Duckworth announcing this week that she's pregnant, and she would be the first senator to give birth while in office.
Yeah, a lot of firsts for her. First Asian-American woman to be elected to Congress, first disabled woman to win from a state, you know, now this. I mean, really inspiring to a lot of Americans, a lot of women.
It's pretty interesting, that stat, that this would be the first woman or first senator to give birth. You're like, that's a head scratcher.
I had to read that headline twice.
There are a lot of things, and listeners helped me when I was filling in this week, that they're like, well, there's an age requirement, and the norm of what a senator comes in is usually over 50 years old. So maybe there is some of that, but it's also starkly points out that it has been a male-dominated field to represent your state or otherwise in the political field.
Right, and she's, what is she, 49?
49,
as well,
yeah.
Which is, you know, maybe on the you know, farther end of the, of the spectrum for that. But right, it was a nice moment.
Jeff Cohn, Lauren Cohn in studio. Lauren Cohn, Jeff Cohn, got it.
It's like an accounting/law firm.
You guys can. We'll shoot our commercial during the news for the for TV. Lauren and Jeff in studio, 312-981-7200. We come back. We'll continue with the winners and also get to the losers. Stay with us. It's Download here, 720 WGN. Thanks, Rob. Lauren Cohn, Jeff Cohen in studio tonight. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Let's keep going with the winners. We had Tammy Duckworth. You know, I wanted to say that I don't think we say this enough. I had on my list Mitch McConnell, who I believe is a winner now and a loser later. in a way that, you know, this week was the government shutdown, and I feel like if you were going to go,
you blinked, you missed it.
Yeah, exactly. But if you were going to go and say there was a political winner, which was all about, it was a stare down. The Republicans and Mitch McConnell came out as winners. Now,
see you in 3 weeks.
Yeah, the problem is that there's an asterisk saying that if he goes back on his word about immigration, everybody knows about it. But I give him. I also say that. I have to say that I thought the tax cuts, I think that the continuing that companies are coming out, I think it was Starbucks came out this week. There were a couple others that came out who were giving bonuses to their employees and continuing that trend of saying because there is tax cuts, we are, you know, trying to give our employees money. That's a winner for Trump. There's a lot of categories for losers as well when it comes to the FBI and other things. But I thought in that case, he continues to win on the narrative about the tax cuts.
Except for you're going to have to check your own balance sheet. You know, I went through this with my accountant to figure out the taxes. Like, is this really going to help me or hurt me? And it's kind of, for me, it's breaking sort of me even this year. And who knows what it's going to be in 2 years. So I said, all right, it's not so bad. It's not so great when you break it down. But I think everybody has to do the math on that one because I think more people are going to see that this isn't something that was great for the rich. A lot of wealthy people are going to be hit hard on this,
and middle class folks. And I also would say that's interesting, and I'm glad you said that, because there is this feeling too that if you do break even, it's a loss, because it has been pitched so hard as a tax cut. I'm giving you money back, but with that, with the deductions missing, and if you just break even and it's the exact same as it was last year, it's a loss for Trump.
Yeah, and I did the math, so I wasn't like, oh, it's I was hurt. But I wasn't helped. I wasn't. Am I getting $2,000 or $4,000 in my pocket? Now give me, next year, and we'll see.
There's a lot of calculators out there, and I think I got a different answer every time I jump.
You know, speaking of elections, and we're going to get to the governor's race, which is heating up, but also this week, when we talk about 2019 and the mayor's race, Paul Vallis's name comes up, an old name here in Chicago politics, ran CPS, came in on that big takeover with Mayor Daley in the mid-90s, but was stepped down as president of Chicago State University to essentially get ready to run for mayor?
Lots of signs, yeah. I had him in the winter column this week just because he got a lot of press that wasn't overly negative, and in the city's sort of continuing search for a possible viable candidate to challenge the mayor, you know, he may be as close as we have right now. You know, starting with the Cast column a few days ago that kind of put him out there. There was news reports that he just recently moved to Lincoln Park, so he'll be just in under the one-year requirement for residency, which, you know, Rahm knows a lot about from 8 years ago or 7 years ago. But, yeah, I mean, he's certainly rattling the chains and looks like he might actually do it. And he does have a lot of baggage of his own, you know, especially related to schools, and he would certainly be opposed by the CTU. And he has ties to the consultant who went down with Barbara Bird Bennett in that scandal. So he would have some work to do. You know, the Tribune, I can just, you know, plug us. We just put up an analysis piece this evening. We posted it by Bill Ruthart, John Byrne, and Patrick O'Connell, which kind of weighs his experience and liabilities, and people can go read that and kind of, sort of like an early examination of what he would be like.
I feel like he just can't help himself. It's sort of like, you know, former Governor Quinn. I got to have my name out there. I got to be in the spot. I got to do something. Why? I think it's time, Paul, you know, step aside. It's the same thing, you know, with Quinn running for attorney general. Hillary Clinton, get over it. Just come on, you know. And yeah. Paul's a likable guy. We've all interviewed him, and he's one of those runaway trains. When you interview him, you can't get a soundbite out of him because he can't stop talking. But he's a nice, likable guy. Yeah. So he has that. But he has not been successful with CPS. He failed miserably in Philadelphia, and I was in Philadelphia at the time. High hopes for Paul Vallis, likable guy, was on the playground if a kid got shot. He was there, but he mismanaged the funds. He expanded too big. He, considering our budget crisis and the way, you know, things are mismanaged, you know. Well, so I think Paul is,
I mean, he had a fan base when he ran against Blagojevich for governor.
He did run in the Democratic primary, right?
But that, you mean, I think he's a different candidate.
That's all we have to run. I mean, obviously, he's been in the private sector, and he's also been in other positions of education, but that's what we know him from, running as a candidate for statewide office. He didn't do well. Mm-hmm. He may have had fans, but he didn't do well. He lost and kind of flamed out, and that's the lasting taste in your mouth about Paul Vallis.
Yeah, and he's a mixed bag on schools, which we just mentioned, and that's going to be one of the real hot buttons.
But where is the charisma? Where is the candidate that we want that's going to go up? You're going to have possibly Gary McCarthy. So who's going to get into this that's going to beat Rahm Emanuel? I mean, who's the person?
Yeah.
Where are you? Run for office. I mean, are you listening?
Yeah,
out there.
There's something to be said about that. I mean, we talked about this last week on The Reload about whether or not Chicago is a progressive town. Can it be like San Francisco and Seattle? The mayor seems to tout that when he goes on Colbert and other places, but the politics seem to be missing, meaning there's not a political candidate that's stepping forward to represent progressives in the city. And you see up and down Chicago right now, it's a very interesting dichotomy. You have cranes all over the place and talks of Tribune Tower skyscrapers and development downtown.
And then you have lots of people without jobs on the south side. You have, you know, people migrating out because it's become unaffordable.
Mass
you have
exodus, right.
Homeless people in, you know, River West, two blocks from me, they've been putting their tents up. You know, they
not
did
to
that
mention violence numbers at the highest we've seen in decades.
You know, the city's reputation is blue, but the real color of politics here is green. And that's exactly what we're talking about here.
You've been sitting on that.
He was waiting.
Right. Let me turn the page for the next one. But yeah, he's a mayor of big business. That's been one of the criticisms of him is, you know, mayor 1% and whatnot. But
and that's why you're not going to get a millionaire big business candidate to come in and run against him, because he already is one.
Yeah, he's got a giant war chest, and I think that's where he's going to have work to do. I mean, we talked about this, how the city center looks great and there are cranes everywhere, but the neighborhoods are emptying out, and he's got a lot of work to do in minority communities, and it could be interesting if
and,
somebody
And they just keep raising our taxes to pay down the pension.
That this, I mean, this is going to be an interesting year because we've been talking about on this program that the huge property tax increase that was last year, there's another one slated for this year and another one coming down the pipe. The point being that with the new tax reforms out of Washington, a lot of those taxes cannot be deducted. It may change the political strategy for the mayor on how he raises money to pay for everything.
Well, and we lost the salt tax, right? So we're going to suffer on that, you know?
Right, that's the point. All right, so that's the winners. You also had the Guggenheim. That's the winners.
I love this story. First of all, I didn't know that a sitting president could call up the Guggenheim and say, you know what, I would like that painting in the Oval Office while I'm here. I didn't know. And I guess apparently other presidents have called up, you know, and asked for great pieces of art. And, well, they're the president, so sure, we'll lend it to you. But the Guggenheim said no on Van Gogh. I don't know why they did. And they offered this curator, who's been very vocal, anti-Trump, then offers the golden toilet. Is that an insult,
guys? It is
an
insult. I think it is. Yeah, I don't know if I enjoy the art curator throwing
a little disrespectful
some shade at
the president.
I agree. I think that's disrespectful. All right, losers coming up here. Let's start with I just mentioned, you have on the list Tribune Tower.
Yeah, and we've all had experience working in this building. And especially for the newspaper reporters who work here, I think it's, we've got a sad period coming up where we're going to be moving out of here. There was the announcement this week of a giant skyscraper going back in the lot mm-hmm. where we park our pool yeah. cars, as a matter of fact, in that exact area. but yeah, it's going to be hard to imagine this as a condo building. You know, we walk through the lobby every day, which is, famous for its etchings of yeah. sayings about press freedom and so forth. And I was liking that a little bit to, like the Fighting Irish running out of the tunnel and slapping their play like yeah, a champion right, today. Right. So, walking, you can't help but kind of get your game face on.
You're inspired walking into this building.
So, I don't know if that's going to be the same at, more of a traditional office space. But, yeah, so I just, it's sad for, I think, a lot of people here.
It is sad because, it's a landmark.
Yeah. And we'll be out of here. So. And hopefully they will have a really good tchotchke jewelry store in the studio. Something maybe
will people be able to see you when they walk by, Justin? Are you going to be in the basement
yeah,
somewhere?
I'm not
some
going
building?
With the radio. I'm going to stay with the tchotchke store.
It could be
I'm employed with the tchotchke store.
It could,
so.
Could be somebody's hot tub complex.
right. So, all right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue. Losers, 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Lauren Cohn, Jeff Cohen in studio. Let's quickly just go to some of the callers are calling. It's unlikely that 773 saying that it's unlikely that Trump's mind will be changed by the Women's March. If the marchers organize ongoing pickets of their legislators' offices, both before and after the midterms, that might affect their thinking. Let's go to Ed. Ed and Joliet. Hey, Ed, what are you thinking? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Justin. This is Loyal Ed and Joliet. I have a comment regarding Trump. I'm a Trump supporter, but Trump is not very nice to the seniors. Do you know that this is the first year in years that I am getting less in my Social Security, even though they say you get a 2% cost of living? That's number one. And I don't know why they should do that. When they say 2% cost of living, then you should get 2% cost of living. And this is the first time that I have my Social Security is less than it has been in years. And then the second point I want to make is, why is Trump not doing something with these banks to give the people who don't have the money in the stock market but want to put some money in savings, why can't they get any interest on their money when everything else is going so good?
Yeah. Well, you're spending the money, and that means that companies and corporations aren't making it. Thanks, Ed. Appreciate it. There's something to be said. I went down the rabbit hole on the solar energy tariffs, and we'll get to that because that is an interesting play about you could put conspiracy theories together, and we'll talk about that coming up. But the conspiracy theory that I've kind of latched onto, I think it's really interesting. I had a friend who pointed this out, that a tax cut means there's more money in your pocket, and then the tariff comes along, and essentially you're going to start seeing goods go up. Meaning that it's not when the tariff comes along, the washing machines and solar energy and everything else that's going to go into balancing the trade means that anything that's coming from overseas is just the costs are going to be pushed on the consumers. It's not,
and then they won't afford them.
Yeah, and so now we got to pay $800, and then you're like, yeah, but now you're going to pay $800 instead of $600, but now we got the money.
Well, in respect to the caller, in terms of there is no place you can put your money to earn interest anymore. It sits in the bank. There isn't the days of Vanguard or places like GE that used to, if you worked for NBC and GE, you could actually put your money into a fund that was earning interest. So if you're not riding the wave of Wall Street, where do you put your money? And that's bank control.
And you saw Bank of America this week in the loser category taking away checking accounts for people who have under 1500 limits or under direct deposits of $250. Whatever it was, there used to be a free checking account, and they are saying that's no longer being offered.
And that is where the disparity is. It's a bit of a different picture on the ground than it is, you know, when you talk about the Dow, and Trump's constantly trumpeting that. The Dow does not equate to the economy. There's a whole...
On the question of the solar panels, though, I've heard economists on both sides of this.
Yeah,
the whole idea, I mean, most people that I've talked to today said, oh, it's a terrible idea because just like you said, you know, this new washer dryer is going to cost me so much money that I'm not going to buy it, which means they're not going to have as much sales and then people are going to get laid off. But yet it was these corporations, not Trump, that started this whole, we need to be competitive with
absolutely.
The foreign market.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I have to say, and we'll get into it. We'll table that because I truly see both sides. And there's also something in there, and I understand the theory that if tariffs are getting in the way of the bottom line of a Samsung or any of these companies that might be in Japan or China, moving to America, setting up shop here and offering jobs for Americans is a way to get around that. So I can see that as a job producer, but it doesn't always work that way. As a matter of fact, many economists say it never works that way. Anyway, we'll talk about that. But we have about 4 or 5 minutes here, and I want to get into the Illinois governor's race because I had that in Winners and Losers. There were debates this week. They were in front of the editorial boards of the newspaper. You started to see a clear picture of where everybody was at. And essentially where they're at is that they just aren't the other candidates. I'm not even sure what any of these candidates stand for, except they stand against the other candidates.
Well, and that's the easy play, right? So when Governor Rana ran against Quinn, he didn't have to say, here's my plan for the economy. He just had to say, here's what Quinn didn't do. Here's where we're at. And that's what's going on now. It's just the mudslinging of this guy, that guy, as opposed to here's my plan. And we as voters and educated, you know, Americans in any race, we want to know, how are you going to help me?
Now more than
ever.
How are
you going to help me?
We just had 4 years of total discord. I mean, that was the worst 4 years of Illinois politics in its history. I mean, we had no budgets balanced.
It should be a hard time to be able to kind of come up with a concrete plan that's better than what we've just
seen. But it's easier for them just to throw some of the other guy under the bus.
It's super annoying. And it's annoying that I have yet to hear an articulate plan from any of the candidates on either side of the aisle about how they're going to deal with pension reform and how they're going to deal with balancing the budget every single year. And I don't know how the people at the Trib, Sun Times, other places are not holding their feet to the fire to say, listen, I know you don't like Kennedy, or I know you want to not say something nice about Pritzker. I know that Rauner is attacking Democrats in his primary. Enough. What are you going to do this time around that's different than the last, or what are you going to do to replace the sitting governor? That's what we need to know right now as voters, because we cannot have another 4 years of what just happened.
Well, and it's easier just to say, you know, I have X amount of money and I can throw you under the bus for this, and it's the battle of the billionaires, and it just takes cover over everything else.
And it's kind of a time period where I think everybody's trying to get their footing still. And you're right, the Rauner kind of wading into the Democratic primary is a little bit unusual, so you have kind of a lot of sniping still at this stage.
Right.
We were talking before, you know, during the break about, you know, it seems like JB's been paying more attention to BIS lately than Kennedy.
Especially in that debate. Right.
Sure. And is that just a strategy to kind of cut Kennedy out of the talking points because he's the bigger threat?
There was an editorial today in the Tribune about calling Kennedy a goofball. Essentially saying Mr. Camelot is now Mr. Goofalot or whatever it was. It was a good line. But, I mean, saying he's just not taking this seriously. He doesn't seem to have it. And I have to say, watching the commercials, the Rauner commercial on JB on the Blagojevich tapes just makes you go, I don't want to. I'm turning this off until March. The one commercial that I have a little bias because Daniel Biss has been on my show a lot, but his commercial showing his family taking milk out of the fridge and getting ready for school, that's something I haven't seen out of Illinois politics. Instead, I see billionaires at factories with hard hats on going, or riding Harleys going, I'm just like you. Where Daniel's got that kind of vibe where he is us. And to me, I wonder if that's going to play. I don't know if he's got the money or the mission or the look or the feel or whatever it might be to be governor, but he definitely has found his footing as the anti-millionaire candidate.
Right, and he's upsetting the apple cart between Kennedy and Pritzker because he's, you know, trying to pull one from the other, right? So it's not going to be Kennedy, it'll be me. But don't count out Jeannie Ives here. You know, we keep talking about the fellas, but let's talk about Jeannie Ives. I mean, she's coming out strong. She doesn't have the money that a governor that Rauner has.
Is Rauner doing the same thing strategy wise by not talking about her and talking about Pritzker instead?
Yeah, I think you sort of look more viable if you attack a candidate who's coming down the road. You know, you're sort of like just sloughing off the immediate challenger and kind of painting them as not being a threat to you.
I mean, he's got money, but he's upset a lot of his base, you know, flipping on Sanctuary Cities and HB 40. And Jeannie Ives is coming out strong and calling him on the carpet and calling him
will
on the carpet
debate?
In terms of taxes.
Will Rauner and Ives
he
debate?
Said no, he won't debate
no,
her.
Huh?
And why?
Yeah,
well,
is
that's
he,
another tactic. Because you don't let her in the conversation.
Yeah, it's working. And you're absolutely right. It's working in the way that the conversation's about Pritzker and Blagojevich
now. You know, the only person I've heard mention that name is you. I mean,
right?
The last few days.
And you know what? Let's take a break because I want to get to the news. But the other issue right there as well is coming up, I think it's the week after next, is the budget address that Governor Rauner has in Springfield. That'll be very interesting because he's already talked about wanting to roll back the income tax hike and get us right back into the budget stuff that's been going on for the last 4 years. Lauren Cohen, Jeff Cohen, we are reloading this week's news on the download. Stay with us. Rob, it is a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Chicago journalist Lauren Cohen, Chicago journalist Jeff Cohen in studio tonight, reloading this week's news. We have moved on to overreported and underreported. Then we'll get to rabbit hole and which story is going to be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 500 years from this week. Let's start with overreported. I'll start. Secret society. Right? That could be one of the most ridiculous stories of all time. The fact that it came out and we're like, is that people are taking this seriously? And I had a couple people, you know, on filling in for Roe. We talked to ABC News reporters and asked the question, is Washington, like the insiders, consultants, media, punditries, are people taking this seriously? Like, no, everyone knows this is a bit. And it turned out to be a bit. And I don't understand how we got all wrapped up in that for 24 hours. And it turned out to be a joke.
Fake news.
Yeah.
It went away completely once the context was released this week. Yeah. Just like flipping a switch, gone.
It did not bode well from the distinguished senator from Wisconsin, I'll tell you that. The other overreported story when it comes to that, and I had it on the list, and it's amazing because you've already mentioned it, Jeff, is Stormy Daniels. The idea of now we have to follow where she's at, what strip club she's going to, and what tour she's on, and this, that, and the other. It's all right. All right, media. You know what? I think we've learned that society doesn't care.
Well, you
so
know,
move on.
It hasn't maxed out yet either because she's going to be on Kimmel, I think, on Tuesday. So you got to...
Now we have to watch.
You got to steal
Thanks,
yourself
Jeff.
For that.
I'll pass. I'll wait for it to show up for Facebook's algorithms.
Right.
I'm only going to show your friends and family. I guarantee I'll wake up on whatever morning and I'll open up Facebook and it'll be like, your friends and family love Jimmy Kimmel.
But that's part of the problem is it's all on social media.
Yeah.
I think if social media wasn't there...
I'd be okay with that.
It is crazy, however, that you can have a story like the current president, you know, paid off a porn star to not talk about their affair. And people are like, you know, whatever.
It's, I mean, it's unbelievable.
What's
right?
next?
Sure.
And then I guess that plays into another overreported I had was just Melania Trump not going to Davos, which, all right. You know, there is absolutely no news in that. There's no source. There's nothing. The idea of watching news organizations speculate on how angry Melania Trump is, I don't know anything about how angry she is. Maybe she doesn't want to go to Switzerland.
I think as a first lady, people aren't paying attention to Melania Trump. Not certainly the way they paid attention to what Michelle Obama was doing or what the Obama girls were doing. They're just not. They're more interested in what Jared Kushner said behind a wall, you know, in the room where it happened.
And is she that angry? Did she wake up on Tuesday and say, wow, this guy's actually a jerk? And,
I'm
not going to switch.
Or first time she'd heard about it, right?
Right. I don't think so.
All right. So the other overreported story, Lauren, you and I both talking about this doomsday clock.
Is there not a doomsday scenario?
This is the clock that scientists, atomic scientists, isn't it the whole idea that if it hits midnight, it's nuclear annihilation? And right now they put it 2 minutes, closest it's ever been. Yeah, and my answer to that is, really? You didn't know that? Everybody knows that. We don't need a clock to tell us that we're on the brink of nuclear annihilation.
Sure. I think it was, wasn't it started as kind of a public awareness situation? I mean, obviously, in the Cold War, everybody was cognizant of it, but just to kind of put the risk factor into a demonstrable object. But when you have things like the false alarm in Hawaii and people are putting their children in the sewers because they think North Korea is attacking, I don't think we need the doomsday clock.
We don't need the doomsday clock. Yeah. We've got Twitter.
Right? Exactly. What happened in Hawaii, though, that was just unbelievable.
Isn't that crazy?
And now the person who was allegedly responsible is not talking.
Why?
Exactly. I saw that today right before I came over here, and I'm like, why wouldn't you talk?
They said that he was refusing to cooperate.
I don't know.
What does that mean?
I'm sure he feels bad.
But what does that mean? I mean, I don't understand how you cannot. You're a government employee that made a mistake on your job. If somebody comes and asks you, and I refuse to cooperate with that.
I don't know the answer, but speaking of Twitter, I did like the GIF this week, which was, it showed like a computer screen and a cursor, you know, arrow moving over, and one button was alert and one was don't alert, and he hovers over don't alert and a pop-up ad appears and moves alert into this, and as he clicks it,
that's what happened. Okay,
all right,
now I understand.
All right, let's keep going. The other overreported story, the serial stowaway, that's on the list. All right, great, good. So she did it again. That's such an interesting story. Much to do about absolutely nothing.
Yeah, it's just, it feels like the 85th time that that's happened, and we only get the bare sort of surfacey reports. I would read it if they would explain how you do that, because I've been on enough flights recently.
So it's not fake news. It's real news.
I just don't see how that's possible.
How do you, right, especially at Heathrow?
Yeah, especially anywhere. It's like we said, it's always a full flight. And if you manage to get on the plane past the person taking tickets at the thing, aren't you in someone's seat? Were you hiding in the overhead compartment? I don't get it.
Yeah. There's a lot. You're absolutely right. And it's the same story every time where a judge went, geez, Sternly, stay away from the airport. Stay away. Because there is a part where you're like, well, okay, I guess you could put her in jail for it. But airline jail? I don't know. I'm done with that story. Let's do underreported. You have the story. I saw the story last week. I put this as my which story will be remembered story. Cape Town, South Africa, facing prospect of being without water shortly. Jeff, this is alarming.
Yeah, and I haven't really seen it even that much in American media. I think I saw it was the Daily Mail or somewhere. But apparently as of April 12th is now the date that they're calling day zero there, where they're going to be mostly without water. And the government's already asking people to take 90-second showers and take the runoff water from the shower and use that to flush the toilet. I mean, it's already like they're in a bad way there. And it's related to, you know, rapid urbanization there, and there's a climate change element. It's just, you know, it's being billed as
the first
world city. It's 4 million people at risk that's going to go dry.
So it's amazing how we take things like that for granted, you know, water.
It's a terrible story. It's to have this in the underreported category also says a lot about us right now, that all the stories we've talked about tonight, this is, you're absolutely right, it's underreported. April 12th, we're not talking in 2028.
And they keep moving it up, too, right? April 12th.
Jeez. All right, another underreported story you have, Lauren. CPS gets washing machines? What is this?
Well, this was actually a great story. I saw that the Sun-Times, sorry, Jeff, that the Sun-Times did it, but
Asleep at the wheel.
I'm out of here.
I know. It kind of broke my heart to see that. I mean, great that CPS was getting donated washing machines and dryers, but the fact that it's because these kids are coming to school every day in the same clothes because they have no place to wash their clothes. And so they have to bring the washers and dryers into the school so the kids can, and it's, where are the parents in all this? And then there were these stories about how these teachers have been taking some of these kids' clothes home and washing it for them. It broke my heart, and I thought, why isn't everybody talking about this? I mean, I'm happy to see the donations, but there's a bigger story here.
Absolutely. When you talk about inequality, and it rears its head in that kind of way when things that we take for granted and don't even think about are happening less than 10 miles from where you live.
I mean, I've covered stories on the public schools when you hear the kids are saying, look, I mean, the other kids are talking about having computers, and, you know, we're lucky if we've got a pencil and a pad. We're carrying our toilet paper to school. I mean, there's things like that, and people forget about that, but that's the reality that so many of these kids go through.
Yeah, I've been in schools for stories, and there's no air conditioning, and, you know, maybe half the rooms have it and half don't.
Lauren Cohn, Jeff Cohen in studio tonight. We're reloading this week's news. We'll come back, talk about what story took us down the rabbit hole and which story is going to be remembered from this week. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. Lauren Cohn, Jeff Cohen in studio. We're getting to the rabbit hole stories. One of the underreported stories we had is, I mentioned in the carryout today, Glenn Seelig, longtime publicist in Chicago, was one of the Americans killed in Kabul when the radical, I guess, what did you say, terrorists, right? Afghani terrorists.
Taliban
came in and killed 22 people in a siege on a hotel there. Glenn Seelig was one, a longtime Chicago publicist that you worked with, Jeff.
Well, right, through the Blagojevich matter. I mean, a lot of us did. I think that's maybe what he was known for most around here. But, that was shocking news this week. And it's hard to tell if it just was underreported because it's a bigger deal maybe in media circles than in other places. But that was kind of a stunner this week.
Chicago in there. All right, let's talk about the rabbit hole stories. Why don't we start with yours, Jeff? I did not see this story, but I always love when you bring the rabbit hole stories. This is interesting. What do you got here?
This is a weird one, and it's kind of because it's a little bit personal for me, because let me start at the beginning. I'm sort of an amateur meteorologist. I love the weather. Always been interested in it.
I didn't know that.
So I had watched this show in the early 2000s, the Storm Chaser show with Reed Timmer. And Joel Taylor was always his driver. They're ripping around the country roads, sort of like, you know, the movie Twister would be, that kind of thing. So early in the week, it comes out that Joel Taylor, his longtime driver guy, has died. And I think he was 38 or something. But there's no detail about how he died. Well, it turns out that he suffered an overdose, possibly of a party drug, on a giant cruise ship that I was personally on last year on a cruise. It was it's one of the biggest cruise ships in the world. I've only been on one cruise. That's another story. So he's on it's a gay party cruise. It's a company that throws these parties for just like exclusively gay clientele. And it's a gigantic party. And
they charter the whole boat.
They charter the entire boat. So I have, a couple of people who are close to me who are on this boat currently with the cruise. And so it comes out first that Joel Taylor died on a cruise. And I kind of put two and two together and actually text these people. And they said, yeah, actually somebody did die. And it's a huge deal. And it's really hush-hush. And there's talk about drug sweeps and everything. And so the boat stops in Puerto Rico. And Joel Taylor's body is taken off the boat. His family has to fly there to ID it. Now the FBI is involved.
Wow.
There's supposed to be zero tolerance for drugs on this boat. Yet it sounds like it was kind of just a fiasco with drugs everywhere. And just really that
wow.
I was reading
gay
everything
party
I could, I was reading everything I could get my hands on.
I didn't know that existed. I need to look more into that. It's interesting.
It's a thing.
But yeah, I would imagine drug overdose in those situations is going to attract a lot of attention.
This may be the very last one, though. Who knows after this?
My rabbit hole story is solar tariffs. I got into that. It's interesting because my wife at one point worked in solar energy, and I feel like I kind of know the nuts and bolts of it. I know that there has been a long time unfairness, really, that Chinese solar energy companies can make the panels a lot cheaper than American companies. And the president is trying to level the playing field that everybody is going to, and he did it with washing machines as well, that by putting a 30% tariff, now you'll use U.S. solar panels or U.S. washing machines and give those companies credit. Reading the National Review, a conservative magazine, they talked about how Which I didn't realize at all, that a lot of times this philosophy has not worked in history. And it's one that doesn't have the affected outcome, which is now everyone's going to buy American. No, what's going to happen is that Samsung and the other companies that are in China and Asia, they're going to jack the prices up. And now we're going, and a lot of times the American companies, because they're trying to make money too, they jack the prices up too. They keep that unlevel. This idea. So the people that lose at the end of the day are not the corporations. They actually make money off the tariffs. Who lose are the U.S. consumers, in the way that we are paying more for the things that we used to pay less.
Well, and this started with the companies. It didn't even start with the president. And so if you want to create, a better advantage for these American companies, and then suddenly you have to lay people off, that's not a win-win advantage. And then, as you mentioned, the whole idea, well, do we get foreign investors then to bring business
Do they avoid
the
tariff by Samsung coming to California or coming to Illinois or whatever? But the problem with that is that it rarely happens. And there's something to be said about that, that there is a system that Samsung has in Tokyo or wherever their plants are, and it gets upended by moving it to a different country.
I want to say I partly want to believe that the president, because he did this so much in the campaign, Make America Great Again, he's just trying to reinforce that Made in America, you know, invest in America, as opposed to, you know, taking from foreign goods.
Right.
And if we're gonna buy, you know, from you, you've got to buy from us, and it's got to be an even.
But aren't
deal.
We in a position where, I mean, that really sounds 1980s, and the way that the idea of America first or buying American, that we've seen that play out even in the automobile industry, where, let's face it, a lot of the cars that were being made in Asia. Honda, Toyota, places they were offering cheaper alternatives, better product. And it gave American consumers the opportunity to pay less. And the idea of going to only American companies does, at the end of the day, mean consumers are going to pay more for those kind of goods.
But it's the jobs. It's the whole optics, the whole perception that it's, if it's made in America, I'm creating jobs. And that's how he won.
Right.
Part of his campaign was...
It's simple. It's much more complicated than that.
Right.
Because if you do get the jobs, and they come in, and let's say they come in at $12 an hour, $15 an hour, maybe $18 an hour. It's all offset by the idea that you're going to have to pay percentages higher for the goods that are not, that you skewed by putting a tariff on foreign goods. So what, essentially, at the end of the day, it's an even split, and the people who make the money are not the people who got jobs, the people who own those corporations. That's the issue, that at the end of the day, this is the corporation
president.
You pulled
Jeff and I down the rabbit hole with
I know, right?
We're in there.
This is it.
We're
like
in the bunker.
It's the Econ 504 rabbit hole.
Right.
But I think you're right, too. We were talking. There's a lag time, too, for companies to really react to this. You can't build a factory in Alabama fast enough before, you know, you build in the idea that there's going to be an administration change, and then we're going to see the needle swing back the other way. So I think these companies are either, you know, willing to wait that out or absorb some of these costs. I mean, I would not, you know, underestimate some of these giant companies' ability to absorb that and stay competitive. I just don't see it.
All right, let's move on. And, you know, I only have about a minute left here. I may have taken your rabbit hole, Lauren. I apologize.
That's quite all right.
It was Tony Preckwinkle and legalizing pot. We get to, next time around, we'll talk 20 minutes about that.
She needs a revenue source, so it's legalizing pot. But at the same time, she's out there talking about the disparity between, she's saying, you know, kids who go at Northwestern or in the suburbs.
Right.
She's talking about white, you know, teenagers, you know, not getting arrested if they're smoking pot, but yet it's different if you're in, you know, an African-American community. And so she's bringing that up at the same time. She's like, we need to legalize pot, you know, for revenue. And she's arguing with Alderman Fioretti, or they're in front of the Trib board.
Yeah.
We need to raise taxes, but I don't know which tax, because we need revenue.
It is a quandary. She has trying very hard to raise revenue, and in the areas that she's trying, she finds total political pushback.
Tony Taxwinkle needs to go.
Tony Dax.
Well, if she legalizes pot, nobody's going to remember it in 5 years.
Yeah, right. All right. Which story is going to be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 50, 500 years from this week? Lauren, you and I have similar ones. USA Gymnastics.
Absolutely.
What happened this week with Larry Nassar?
Yeah, I mean, just the emotion, it's still in my head
and it could
with the
be,
words of those.
And it could
girls.
Be next week and the week after and the week after and the week after at this
and,
point.
And who so knows we'll how it's going to affect the actual sport, you mm-hmm. know, and the teams that we put on.
I got a lot of pushback when I threw out the idea that maybe U.S. Gymnastics need to take a break from the Olympics for a couple of years as punishment. The callers called in very irate, saying don't punish the athletes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I can get that, but there also has to be some accountability from the U.S. Olympic Committee. And I don't just mean USA Gymnastics, but they're going to try to act like we had no idea. But 156 victims makes you go, somebody somewhere knew what was going on. Jeff, you had one that was different. DACA, we didn't even get a chance to talk DACA. That's, I mean, but that you see that being a story we're going to remember.
Sure, and I mean, it's tied up in the shutdown talks and everything else. But, I mean, that literally affects hundreds of thousands of dreamers and, you know, millions of family members. And whatever the outcome of that is, they will obviously definitely remember it in five or how many years it is. So, for sure.
You guys are amazing. You guys, this is an hour and a half of power radio, and I appreciate you being here. Lauren Cohn, Jeff Cohen.
You launched my singing career, so I just want to thank you for that.
These were also two ensemble members for Children Go Where I Send Thee.
Thankfully, you didn't open with that. You were with a mass turnoffs.
It was live music at its best. You guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Oh, that's so fun. These guys are great. So good. 847 says marijuana must be, this is Sue from Glenview, marijuana must be healthy since Preckwinkle wants to legalize it. She's also all about our health, right?
Penny per ounce.
Good stuff about, and 312 says underreported, you haven't mentioned the death of Teletubby Tinky Winky.
Yeah. So we'll get Jerry Falwell on that one.
Yeah. 773 says graduated high school in 1988. I never had air conditioning in grade school or high school. Why they need it now? It's good. And 773 says, I heard Melania stayed home to focus on her bullying platform. So there you go.
Ooh.
Really taking shots.
Wow.
Really getting deep.
Meow.
Zingers.
Meow.
All right, coming up, Derek Miller from Sleigh Bells is going to join us. They're going to be at Metro coming up on Monday. Great indie rock duo. And then Eddie the Chief Clearwater joins us in the 10 o'clock hour. We'll talk about the history of Chicago blues. How about that? Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up on the 31st, Metro will host the indie rock noise pop duo from Brooklyn, known as Sleigh Bell. Sleigh Bells is a duo of vocalist Alexis Krauss and guitarist Derek Miller. They burst on the New York City music scene back in 2010 with their outstanding debut album, Treats. Since then, they put out three more albums and the latest EP called Kid Khrushchev. To say the music produced by Sleigh Bells is indie rock is doing it a disservice. It's much more than that. It's rock, it's electronic, it's pop, it's even got a little R&B in it. And the beats crafted by Derek Miller expertly move this music to the forefront. In short, it's Sleigh Bells. Like I said, the band coming to Metro on the 31st, and Derek Miller joins me now. Derek, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Yes, sir. What's up, Justin? Thanks for having me, man.
First off, how often do you get through Chicago and talk about how important it is to play Chicago, play places like the Metro?
I mean, I think the Metro is up there with, like, 930 Club in D.C. is one of the, I mean, easily one of my favorite venues to play in America. I mean, a lot of that, to be honest, has to do with the crowd. I mean, Chicago's just, I don't know, it's just got a vibe. People aren't uptight. Everybody shows up to have a good time. And I mean, really, for me, that's essential. If it's going to be a good show, there's got to be some type of reciprocation. You know, the crowd really does a lot of the work, to be perfectly honest. So, I mean, it's killer. I love it to death. I love Chicago. And I mean, I've been playing the Metro since I was a little kid, because I played in a hardcore band when I was from like 16 to 23 called Poison the Well. So I think the first time I played the Metro was like 2000 or 2001. So, I mean, I've been coming through there for like 17 years, so it's got a lot of history with the place. I love Chicago. It's just a badass, hardworking town, and yeah, man, I love it. Always happy to be there.
It's amazing to think that you've been playing a place like Metro for 17 years. Talk about how you have evolved as a musician from the time that you were just talking about in a hardcore band and punk music to what you're doing now at Kid Khrushchev. There has been an evolution in the music of Derek Miller and Sleigh Bells. Talk about how you see the music that you're producing now versus what you were doing 17 years ago.
You know, with Poison the Well, it was... I mean, it was a five-piece band. It was democratic, so the chemistry was very different. There was a lot of fighting, you know, young dudes, everybody's headstrong, that's to be expected. But I just wanted to shift gears. I was sick of I like the intensity of hardcore, and especially in the live setting, but I'm not a big fan of the aggression or especially violence. I'm not a fan of violence at shows. I mean, when I hear people kind of talk about how it used to be back in the day, like, oh, you could get hurt at a show, I mean, I think that's really sick and kind of misguided. I mean, I'm all about intensity and energy, but I don't think that, hardcore is just different, man. Kids get beat up every single night. I mean, we were in brawls. We had our tires slashed. And I was just sick of that, man. I wanted to be in a band. I wanted I wanted to work with a woman, a female songwriter. I've always been a fan. I was sort of raised on by my mother a lot of like the female pop titans of the late 80s. You know, Cyndi Lauper, Madonna. I liked the Belinda Carlisle solo stuff a lot. Like, those records are really close to my heart. So really kind of marrying that type of stuff with hardcore is comes naturally to me. And I just like the contrast there. I think something interesting happens. And it was new. You know, this is ambitious, but I didn't want to be, musically, I didn't want to be in a pre-existing lane. You know, I really wanted to create our own sound and just be a totally singular band. I wanted to be singular artists. And I also wanted it to be fun. I mean, I'm dead serious about it, but I wanted it to be a blast, you know? So, like, I hope we've never really lost that. Some of the new stuff is a little lusher and not quite as aggressive, but, you know, I'm always going to love, like, but there's still like tracks like Favorite Transgressions is a track off Kid Khrushchev. Like big drums, big riffs, and that stuff just never really compared to me.
That's the sleigh bell sound. I mean, that guitar riff and obviously Alexis's voice. But there is something about that that in 2010, that was what grabbed people. As you evolve with the albums, of course, but also with the EP, and like you just mentioned with Kid Khrushchev, you start to move into a, like you said, a more lush sound, something a little bit different. Is that by design? Are you changing the way that you guys sound? Are you narrowing the way that you sound? Talk about the evolution of sleigh bells.
It's really just about, honestly, man, whatever inspires me, whatever excites my ears, and whatever, like, when I'm working on something and I'm ready to kick down my friend's door, you know, to play it for him, that's when I feel like it's ready to go, you know? That's really all it is. There's no master plan, you know? It's just one day at a time. But I do tend to, like, rebound from things. Like, so Khrushchev's, like we were both saying, is kind of more lush and has quieter tracks. A lot of stuff I'm working on now is, like, pretty obnoxiously loud again, and it's a reaction to it. It's a little heavier, and it's a little more aggressive, but that's just for now, you know what I mean? It's like 6 months from now. We always have stuff in the oven. We always have new songs that we're working on as we're completing a new batch. So, like, now that we just wrapped up this one, I've just did, like, you know, kind of dove headfirst into these new jams, and we're going on tour, of course, you know, because we're coming through Chicago. Yeah. I always set up a studio in the back of the bus, so we'll see what happens there. We always get a lot of work done on tour. But, yeah, I don't know, man. It's just whatever excites me, whatever is inspiring, and whatever is memorable, you know, I feel like can fit under the sleigh bells umbrella.
You know, I'm interested because I was reading a bunch about how you produce and put the music together, and a lot of it done in your Brooklyn apartment, and how Kid Khrushchev actually was a little bit different in the way that you traveled to Alexis's place and you did things more out in the woods. But there was something special about the idea that you spend a lot of time in one studio. Talk about your process. It's important to be close to environments that are comfortable, that you understand and know and be able to produce and that kind of thing, as opposed to going into a fresh studio to do something that maybe that you've never been in before?
Yeah, it does help. I mean, I work best and I'm most productive when I'm home. I mean, a typical day would be I'll wake up, I've been boxing for a number of years, so I go to the gym, and I really do that. I mean, it's nice to try to keep in shape, but it's a chemical thing. I mean, I leave the gym just happy. I don't know how else to put it, you know. It puts me in a great headspace. It's truly a chemical thing. It really is, you know. So I come home and I got a lot, you know, it just feels good. And I usually have a track open and I'll work on it throughout the day. You know, I'll go to a movie, but I'll spend give or take, you know, 2 or 3 hours with a session open, and I'll do it in bursts though. You know, I'll work for 15, 20 minutes, get something going, and then kind of take a break, come back to it and just tweak throughout the day. I'm not really a fan of just sitting in front of my computer for 8 hours straight. It's not a whole hell of a lot of fun. Yeah, right. So I'm usually, just kind of coming back to it throughout the day, and it'll evolve slowly over a couple of months. That being said, honestly, man, environment is not super important to me. I feel like, I mean, you could put me in a giant shoebox and poke holes in it, like a gerbil or something. And if I had my equipment with me and I could make a record, I will make a record in a shoebox. It does not really matter to me, you know? Like, I've been in the same apartment now for about 5 or 6 years. It's a nice spot. But when I moved to Brooklyn, you know, I lived in like a $400 apartment. It truly was actually kind of a shoebox. It was like a closet. And I made records there too. You know, I'm not that picky about it. Time is the most important thing. I just need the time for myself to do it. And it's a privilege to have that. You know, we've worked for it, but I'm also lucky and grateful. That's really the main thing. You know, I'd do it anywhere. I just need the time.
Obviously, with more time allotted to be able to do it, does it change the way you approach the music with having more time available? And take us back to even when you didn't have time. Was there a format and a style in which you did things, and now you've been able to replicate that record after record? Or does the time that's available to you now, does it change the way that you actually produce your music?
I don't think it does. We're just more productive now. You know, when I met Alexis, I was waiting tables. I was actually her waiter. I met her at the restaurant I was working at. And I was working 6 nights a week, you know, doubles most days. So, and she was teaching. She was a teacher. So we'd have like one night a week to work, and it just wasn't enough. So now that this has been our job for coming up on a decade, I feel, you know, we have 5 records, four in an EP, just because we have the time to do it. It's my job, and I take it very seriously. And I never leave it alone for too long. You know, I might go a week without working on music, but max, you know, usually like it's an everyday thing. I like to stay in the rhythm of it.
As you know, you said you got new music coming out, and when you're going to go on tour here with Sleigh Bells, of course, you know, you got the studio in the back of the bus. How much of this is for the foreseeable future, what you do? Are there other creative endeavors and pursuits that you look for as an artist beyond producing music? Or is this sort of, you have the time, so now you're going to double down and continue this pursuit?
You know, I've either directed or co-directed all of our music videos, and I write most of the treatments. I'm really passionate about that. I'm a film dude. I wouldn't call myself a cinephile, but I see a lot of movies, and I'm very passionate about it. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I'm ready to direct a feature. My God, no. I just don't know quite enough about the craft yet. But I am obsessive, and I do love it just about as much as I love listening to records and making records. So that's something I'm interested in. But to be perfectly honest, man, I don't really look that far down the road. I don't know. I'm just really aware of my own mortality. You know, I lost my dad a while back, and his death was sudden and tragic. So I don't know. I think the difference between me and a lot of people is that on a scale of 0 to 10, how certain am I that tomorrow's going to happen? I don't really know. If I ask you for real, like pretty much you're 100% that you're going to wake up tomorrow morning and life will continue. Truly, I don't know that. So I'm in the moment, you know, for real. So Sleigh Bells is it right now. If I make it, I'm 36. I mean, if I make it to 40, God knows what I'll, you know, I don't know. But I can't tell you that Sleigh Bells is my number one priority, and I don't do it so I could do anything else. You know, it really is my American dream. I love it to death, and if there's nothing else I'd rather do. You know, I've said this a bunch, so I don't mean to be a broken record, but like for real, if you tacked on like 10 zeros to my account balance, I would wake up and do Sleigh Bells tomorrow morning with Alexis.
Awesome.
It's like, it's, you know, it's my number one thing. So I don't necessarily take myself that seriously all the time, but I do take Sleigh Bells very seriously, and you know, I cherish it and I work hard on it. So, yeah, man, honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if we did this for another 10 years. It's a beautiful thing, and I don't know why we would stop. I think one of us is going to have to die, which is a terrible thought.
Well, here's to making it to 40, and here's to the 31st at Metro. Derek Miller, guitar player, producer, one half of Sleigh Bells, which will be at the Metro coming up on the 31st. Derek, thanks so much for taking some time out tonight. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Justin, man. I'm much appreciated. Thanks for having me, dude.
I'll listen to Rob Martire's news. Eddie the Chief coming up, a longtime blues man here in Chicago, came to Chicago back in 1950, around that time. 68 years of Chicago blues. Talk with him about breaking the color barrier, coming over to the north side to play places like Kingston Mines. He was a regular there for years. We'll talk about the lifetime's career in the Chicago blues. Chicago blues man, Eddie the Chief, Clearwater. Coming up. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a blues guitar legend in the city of Chicago. Everyone knows the Chief. Eddie the Chief Clearwater has been a staple in Chicago blues since, well, since he moved up here from the South in the 50s. But it was the 1980 album, The Chief, that made his presence felt. Clearwater and his electric guitar are true blue Chicago. Eddie and others helped bring that electric guitar sound to the scene and also are credited with bringing the blues out of the south and west sides of Chicago as he set up shop as one of the stars that headlined weekly at the Kingston Mines in Lincoln Park. Clearwater has released several albums, toured the world over, and brought tourists from far and wide to sample his music and the music that gave this town its soundtrack. Clearwater just turned 83 years old, and with that, I say happy birthday, and I welcome Eddie the Chief Clearwater to the big table tonight. It's a pleasure and an honor to meet you, sir. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you very much. It's
a good birthday. To be here. And happy Thank birthday. You. To have a conversation with you tonight is to have a conversation about Chicago blues. I have so many different questions about coming here from the South, about playing the clubs when you were a young man, about how you picked up the guitar. But why don't we start with what does the blues at the age 83, does it still mean the same to you as it did when you were a kid coming to Chicago in 1950?
It still means the same thing, I'll tell you the truth. It's about feeling and just knowing, enjoying the energy of the blues, because it's a very energetic thing to do, and it's just a good feeling inside. So the longer I do it, the better I feel. As long as I'm healthy, I figure, why not? Why not do it?
Yeah. You started in gospel music.
I started.
When you were a young kid, you're 13 years old, right?
13 years old, yeah, back in Mississippi.
Talk about the origins of learning the guitar and playing that music before you were even introduced to the blues.
Well, that's a dream I always had in my head. I want to play music for a living and write songs and stuff like that. So I just listened to some people like Lightnin' Hopkins, John Lee Hooker, and Muddy Waters, and then Chuck Berry later on. I said, hey, this is the way for me to go.
What made you come to Chicago? What was it about Chicago? What did you know about Chicago and the music that was here when you were in Alabama?
I had heard that Chicago had a blues reputation. I didn't know any of the players that was here personally, but I knew about them. People like Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Jimmy Reed. They were all in Chicago at that time in the 50s playing blues every night from club to club. So I told my Uncle Houston, I said, that's where I'd like to go. So he came to Chicago before I did. So he wrote me a letter in Birmingham saying, you said you wanted to pursue blues as a career. He said, if you come to Chicago, you'll get that opportunity, because there's people in Chicago that does blues every night for a living. So that's as good as I wanted to hear. I said, well, I wrote him back and said, send me a ticket. So he sent me a ticket on the Greyhound bus, September of 1950, a ticket for $15. So I got on the bus by myself. My grandparents gave me permission to go as long as my uncle looked after me. So that was always my best uncle anyway.
And at this point, if it's the early 50s, you're a teenager.
Yes.
So you learned the guitar upside down, left-handed.
Left-handed, yes. Backward, all backwards.
All backwards at the age of 13. And you're ready to move to the big city of Chicago to try to be a professional musician?
You know, I had full confidence. I just had a lot of belief that I could make it work. It was scary coming to Chicago. A 15-year-old boy coming to Chicago with no one there except an uncle. It was real scary, but I'm going to take a chance. And my grandparents, they wished me luck and said, you're on your way, your uncle will look after you and get on your feet. So that's what I did. You know?
There's always talk in blues, and I've had different blues musicians on talking about what makes the Chicago blues sound distinct. And a lot of times they will point to the guitar, the electric guitar being a big staple of the Chicago blues sound. You know, you can talk to different parts of the country, have different sounds. It seems like a perfect fit for you? Was it a perfect fit to come to Chicago and have the what you were learning and how you were playing the guitar in Alabama to come to Chicago and meld those two? Or did you have to change the style in which you were playing blues to a more Chicago style?
Oh, no. It sounded right for me, and it felt right. Because when I first walked in, like the Civio Club, Civio used to be on West Lake Street. I walked in there, and there were people like Howlin' Wolf playing there, and my uncle took me there, and I said, this is the atmosphere that I was looking for, just the way I had imagined it to be.
What do you remember about those clubs? Take us back, if you can, in your memory to walking in, the sounds, the smells, what did Club Civio's look like?
Well, it's just a very common-looking club, but the music is what took me over. You know, I said, well, the decor was not that great or anything, but it was just the music itself. It was just overtaking. So felt so energetic. Just the atmosphere of being there and see the reaction of the people when they hear the music. When Wild Wolf would get up and howl, I'm going to howl the blues for you. And those women start yelling, whoa, Howlin' Wolf. You know.
How long did it take you to get the confidence to say, hey, can I sit in? I'd like to play something. Talk about that first inclination to, actually, it's one thing to move to Chicago to play the blues, but when you're in that setting and you get a chance to actually get up on stage, it's probably pretty frightening.
Very frightening. The first person that gave me courage to go on stage, it was Magic Sam.
Wow.
Because before that, I would just go and listen. I would sit quiet in a corner someplace. That's how I first listened to Muddy. At the 708 Club, 708 East 47th Street. I walked in. Well, I didn't walk in because I was only 18 years old, and there was a doorman at the door taking the money and checking IDs. So I called him when he was busy, and I snuck by him, and over in the corner of the club, there was a seat. I went there, I sat down, and I wouldn't order anything to drink. I just ordered a Coke because I knew they were going to ask me for my ID.
Right.
So I figured I can order a Coke and get away with it. They won't say anything as long as it's not alcohol. So I got my Coke, and I sat there the whole night listening to Muddy Waters, and I got blues religion that night. Believe me, I did, yes.
But it was Magic Sam that said, get up here.
Magic Sam gave me the courage to go on stage myself and pick up a guitar and play in front of people. Before that, I was just too shy. I couldn't do it.
Well, it's hard to believe seeing Eddie the Chief Clearwater play today, even today at the age of 83. You would never assume you to be a shy 18-year-old kid who didn't want to get up on stage. Eddie the Chief Clearwater, my guest in studio, Chicago blues legend, talk about upcoming project, a new LP that's coming out, and also the fact that for your birthday, the city of Westmont, city of Skokie, everybody making it Eddie Clearwater Day around Chicagoland. Eddie the Chief Clearwater, my guest at the big table tonight. We'll take a quick break, come back, continue the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight at the big table, Eddie the Chief Clearwater, blues legend in studio, talking about coming up here from Alabama, originally from Mississippi, and becoming a staple in the Chicago blues scene. Just turned 83 years old. We wish you a happy birthday, all of Chicago. You know, as we continue the conversation about your life in music, once you got acclimated to the stage and you started to play, talk about the Chicago blues scene of the 60s and the time when you start to, even the 50s, started to regularly perform. Where was it mostly taking place, the clubs, the sound? Talk about that time in your life.
Yes, most of the blues clubs at that time was on the west side and the south side of Chicago. Primarily on the west side, that's where a lot of gutted blues was played, like people like Otis Rush. And a little later on, Luther Allison, he came on a little bit later, but he came in strong.
Right.
So it would be the south side or the west side. That's where every night of the week they'd have a blues band playing someplace in Chicago, like on 63rd Street. There was blues clubs all up and down 63rd Street.
Hmm.
You could go from one club right into the other, next door, like the Green Door and people like that. People like Muddy used to play there and Earl Hooker, I used to go from place to place and just listen to
people. And there was a crowd for that.
Oh, yeah.
People would go out all
every night, all week long, yeah.
And how hard was it for you to book those places? Was there a lot of competition for young artists, blues artists that were coming up in the 50s and 60s that wanted to be on that stage?
Yeah, oh yeah, there was a lot of people because, see, people like Muddy and Wolf, they were the biggest names in the Chicago area at that time. And everyone else was just up and coming, but they were already named well-built and because of Chess Records. And they got contract with Chess Records and Little Walter and people like
that. So a lot of musicians were coming to Chicago because
of
just, Chess.
Yeah, because of the atmosphere. They said, go to Chicago, you can play blues and people will come out to listen to you every night. You know,
it's so interesting listening to your music all day today and different styles and different times of your career. One thing that really holds true is the guitar. And, you know, there's a lot of different music in Chicago blues and it could, or just in blues, piano and, you know, the singing and all that kind of stuff. And you do all the stuff that's on your records as well.
Oh, yes.
But that electric guitar, there's something about the blues electric guitar.
The electric guitar just speaks. That's the dominant in blues is the guitar, electric guitar. Very dominant. Like B.B. King, people like that, Lightning Hopkins. It had that goody sound.
Yeah, and it's... Listening to it today, and there was this moment where I wanted to ask you about the connection, the emotion, and the intimacy, because the blues is a very emotional music.
It is,
It's about struggle, and it's about putting your heart on your sleeve and talking
conditions
about
of life, absolutely. That's what it's about.
But there's something about the electric guitar in that mix that is beautiful. It's this emotional... I can't think of another kind of music where it plays out just like this, where it almost feels like it's crying.
Yeah, it does. Oh,
right.
Yeah.
Do you feel the same way about that?
Oh, I feel very much the same way. That's why I was so attracted to Earl Hooker's playing, because he was known as a monster, man. This guy would grab that guitar, and he'd bring out sound that would just... All the musicians were saying, you got to hear Earl Hooker play. You got to hear Earl Hooker. That guy was very fantastic.
As a young musician who you taught yourself how to play upside down,
yes,
left-handed.
Yeah, self-taught. Yeah.
As you developed yourself in the scene, became a regular player in Chicago, how did you expand yourself as a musician? How did you push yourself to learn the instrument and continue to make that electric guitar sound part of your repertoire?
Well, I would just go out as much as possible and listen to different people play because... All of them, they have their own style, whether it's something minor or major. It's something different about each player's sound. It's like Elmo James, you know, he was known for the slide. You take all of this and you put it in your head and figure out, what can I get from that? So what you do, and then combine it with what I have from myself and I put it together. Like I listened to Chuck Berry, and I listened to Magic Sam, and I said, well... I could combine some of this because there's some licks in there that Chuck is playing and there's some licks Magic Sam is playing and I can put the lyrics together and try and come up with something, you know. So that's what I try to do.
The one thing about your career, and we're going to get into the records and all the touring and everything and talk about the new project as well. It's interesting that you are credited with bringing the blues from the west side of Chicago, from the south side, and bringing it to the north side of Chicago, which is predominantly white, not necessarily where you would think that the blues would have a prominent space. But you became one of the pioneers, if you will, of coming to the north side, playing Kingston Mines, becoming a regular at Kingston Mines and the college circuit in Lincoln Park around DePaul. Talk about the idea of getting out of your comfort zone on the west side of Chicago and playing on Halsted Street.
Right, okay, because I could always enjoy and I always liked listening to country music, country western. I always hear that as having a place within the blues. Somehow you can mix that and make it make sense, you know. So I always would try, every time I pick my guitar up, I would play some blues and I'd say, Hank Williams tune, your old cheating heart will make you weep. You cry and cry, but cannot sleep, because sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you. Then I started figuring out with some twangy licks that sounds like country western. And some of the club owners found out that I could play some blues, like Hank Williams and Jerry Lee Lewis and stuff like that, Fats Domino. And I love all of that stuff. And that was just part of my game because I could hear it all the time.
And so they were more inclined to have you come play at the clubs because it wasn't
because of the diversity. They would say, well, he not only plays blues, he plays rock and roll. That's how I first got my introduction into like the western suburbs, the white areas and stuff. Because they said, he not only plays blues, he plays a little bit of country music and stuff. So I always associated it all as music. To me, it's all like the same family.
Well, I would have assumed, and maybe I assume incorrectly, but in the 60s, in the West Side clubs in Chicago, it was predominantly African-American crowd that
right,
was watching.
Yes. But at that time.
But to come to Kingston Mines or come to the North Side, it becomes a predominantly white crowd.
Right.
See, is it different in your eyes when you play a show and it might be a different audience in front of you?
The white people are more susceptible to blues than a black person would be, because the reason is a lot of black people take blues for granted because they say, well, oh, that's black music.
I grew up with it in my house.
See what
like
I mean?
Right. Yeah,
yeah,
so, right, right,
yeah.
Of course.
So they figured, see, like the best flowers could be the flowers in your own backyard, but you don't pay attention to them. You know why? Because you see them every day. You say, well, that's just some flowers. They look all right. But people from Europe and places like that,
yeah,
it took the British to introduce Muddy Waters to the black audience in America.
Yeah, you're right.
They had to take it and say, guess
what? Give it to the Rolling Stones.
The Rolling Stones,
yeah, right.
Yeah, the Beatles. Look at what you got. The Beatles did Chuck Berry songs, and the Stones did Muddy Waters.
As a blues musician in Chicago, and you see that happening in the mid-60s, where you have the Beatles and the Rolling Stones essentially taking blues riffs and turning it into pop songs that were on the charts.
Right.
How did you feel about that? Were you aware that that was happening at the time?
Oh, I was aware of it because I could hear it before it was ever announced. When I could hear the record, I could hear, oh, that's part of Hoochie Coochie Man. They put a lick that's in Hoochie Coochie Man. I could hear it. And then finally, people like Eric Clapton, they started to say, this song and that song, I got this from Muddy Waters. You know, what I give them, I really feel honored that they was honest enough. Like Stevie Ray Vaughan, you know, mm-hmm. he'd tell anybody, well, Albert King, that's where I got my style from.
Yeah, you watched and listened to different people on stage, and you were able to combine it to make your style.
Exactly.
So it was similar in the same concept, but at least they had finally started to admit it.
Oh, yeah, right.
Eddie the Chief Clearwater, Chicago blues legend, in studio with me tonight. We're talking about his legendary career, and he's got some new music we're going to talk about in just a second. He just turned 83 years old. Both Westmont and Skokie gave him proclamations, Eddie the Chief Clearwater Day, both those towns. We'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back more with Eddie the Chief Clearwater in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, Eddie the Chief Clearwater, Chicago blues legend. Several albums, toured the world over. We'll talk about all that. Also, as we're talking about, you know, was a pioneer in taking the blues out of the west and south sides of Chicago and bringing it to the north side. And you think about that, that's a big deal because a lot of the blues clubs that still stand today are on the north side of Chicago that are close by DePaul University. But you've had a career in pushing the boundaries of what was acceptable in clubs, breaking color barriers and things of that nature. I mean, Chicago has played that role in the suburbs. You talked about the western suburbs, but you also broke the color line in Round Lake, other places like that.
What I did when I first started appearing on the north side of Chicago in the western suburbs, I'd go in, they'd book me, I'd go in, I'd play a couple of blues songs, like, say, by Bobby Blue Bland, Jimmy Reed, B.B. King. I'd play a few blues songs, but that, I knew there was a lot of young white kids there. They want to get up and dance. So then I'd switch over to Chuck Berry.
Right.
Fats Domino. I like the way you walk.
Were you ever uncomfortable with being that kind of artist that would break the color barrier, that would go into places that had never had an African-American on stage or never allowed an African-American to be on stage?
I always thought, well, if the people get to hear it, young people, if they get to hear it, like they got to hear the blues, but they had never really heard it in a great sense, because the radio at that time wasn't playing a lot of blues. So I would introduce a little bit of it, but then I knew the kids wanted to dance to something, mm-hmm. and I knew they know who Chuck Berry is. You know, They know who Fats Domino is. They know who Little Richard is. Bop, bop, a bop, a lop, bam, bam, tutti frutti. I would play that, and the kids would get up and dance, all the white kids. And they said, oh, this guy is good. He's not only playing blues, he's playing rock and roll. I was like, that's what I was brought up with, listening to people like Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, and I play that. And then I play a little blues enough to let them know what I...
To give them a sample.
Yeah, exactly. Right, right. Thank you. Right.
Well, you played throughout the 60s and 70s and even into the early 80s as a club regular in Chicago.
Right.
You played all the clubs you're talking about and all the places either on the north side, west side, south side. But it wasn't until the early 80s that you had success by putting out albums and started to get a following, not just here in Chicago, but around the country, around the world. Talk about the idea of transitioning from a Chicago regular, essentially a session musician playing in the clubs, to somebody whose name was out front and was known around the world.
Well, what happened, I was looking for a record company that would take me and record. So it was a little while before Alligator paid attention to me. They just thought I was just a Chuck Berry imitator at the beginning. So then when Jim O'Neill recorded the Chief album on Rooster Blues Records, Jim said, I want you to do some of the original blues songs on the album. I said, hey, that's what, exactly what I want to do.
Been waiting for, right?
Right, exactly, the opportunity. So Jim introduced that album, and then Jim, he came back to me, and Jim said, if Bruce had heard you do this kind of stuff earlier, he would have recorded you way before now. He said he never realized that you were not just a Chuck Berry imitator. Right. He didn't realize that you have a blues side underneath that. Because, well, I came from the South, and I should
because
be able to play
blues. And you're going and playing in these clubs and on the north side and other places, so when the people come to watch you from Alligator or other places, you are doing the Chuck Berry and stuff because you're entertaining the audiences at the time.
Right,
so
exactly.
They think you're a club act.
Exactly, right. They figure, well, it's just a club act. But then when we had the record party for the Chief album, we had it at Billy Mulligan's. So Jim, who shows up? Bruce Iglau.
Alligator Records, of course.
Yes. He picked the album up and he said, as much as I hate to admit it, but you made a damn good record. I said, well, thank you.
Eddie, it's obviously starts a huge career for you. You really look to the 80s and the 90s. Blues music in Chicago, and I would even say this country, started to dwindle in the way it was played on the radio and the sales for the albums, but at the same time exploded in Europe in the way that many blues musicians today, including yourself, can continue to tour Europe to major audiences, where if you tried to do the same kind of tour in the West Coast, it might not be the same.
We may not. You won't get the same reception.
How do you feel about that? For all the success you had and thinking back and looking at your discography, it's amazing how many albums that you've put out to be a star somewhere other than where you live.
Well, it's just a fact of life, like I just said about the flowers. You're less appreciated close to home. Not to bring anything religious into it, but Jesus, he only became a very famous person when he left his home. And then everybody said, oh, this guy Jesus, he's something magical. So that's the same thing happened when we go to Europe. It's like it took Europe to really bring out Jimi Hendrix. Because they just thought he was just a local player before that. So when he went to Britain, he came back a super, superstar.
You had your own club here, Reservations,
restaurant.
Blues, in Wicker Park. I lived right around the corner for a while. I used to go in and see you, see the players that were in the back. Of course. You've also talked in this interview about 63rd Street, and there was a line of blues
down 63rd,
up and down.
The swing club.
You talk about the West Side and Lake Street, these great addresses and clubs that are not around anymore.
Right, like the 1815 Club.
How does it make you feel to still be a blues performer, professional, as putting out records, getting named by cities for your birthday, to be in a city in which that history has eroded in the way that it's not there anymore? It's really hard to find a blues history in the city of Chicago.
Right. Well, it's kind of sad. But I think my prediction is it's going to roll back around. I think it's going to escalate because a lot of people now are thinking of doing blues that never really attempted to do blues before. So I predict it's going to come back around. And it's going to escalate in a much bigger form, you know, just like Buddy Guy's Club, the Legends, yeah.
That's one of the strongest clubs going in the whole country.
Right, exactly, yes.
You know, I just wonder, and Pete and I were talking about, do you think of places like Memphis, Austin, Texas, Nashville?
Right.
Where you can go down to the main drag and there will be bar after bar after bar playing live music, whatever music it might be, country music or blues. And you think about, why can't that be in Chicago? Why can't State Street between Adams and Van Buren, you know, be line of clubs?
The designated area for
blues. Do you think about
clubs.
That? Because there's been push to try and make a blues designation Motor Road.
South Michigan Avenue.
Yeah, and it's always kind of faltered.
Right, yeah.
What do you think about? What do you think about when you talk about the future? Can you see a Chicago in which the blues is accepted the way it was in the 50s and 60s when you came here?
Yeah, I can visualize it. I predict very strongly that it's going to come back. The blues is a great foundation for a lot of things, a lot of music here.
You know, as we wrap up, I think about the blues, you know, as you mentioned about the struggles of life, and you hear it in the music. You know, you're a great songwriter, and you hear it throughout the records I listened to today, the story of the parts of the human experience that don't necessarily get told as much, heartbreak and everything. And to me, I wonder about whether or not that art, the art of the blues, writing a blues song, will stay with us forever. Do you think
I think it will. That's what will stay around, the blues songs, because sooner or later, just like some of the songs that's out today that are real popular, songs like Further On Up the Road, people like Joe Bonamassa, the guitar player. He's doing a lot of black people's songs, which is good, because it's giving them some play and notoriety. So these songs are going to stay around, and new songs are going to be written, and I think they'll stay around.
But when I listen to pop music today, I hear Have a Fun Time all the time. I hear Let's Party every day. I hear a lot of stuff that is the antithesis of the blues song, which what I always was attracted to is the fact that you as a professional artist and someone who's on stage is able to tell us that you too have troubles, you too have issues, you too have frustrations.
Exactly.
That there's something great about being able to connect to an artist in this art form, that it's not all, let's have a good time, clap your hands.
Yeah, see, there's more to reality than that, you know. It's you take the good time with the bad. As Muddy Waters say, take the bitter with the sweet. That's good days and that's bad days. That's a fact of life. But you have to anticipate it and say, well, I have enough faith and I have enough strength that I can endure the bad time, because I know there's better time. That's why I wrote the song, Good Times Are Coming. Mm-hmm. Don't let the bad times get you down.
Well, this was a good day. Any day you get a chance to sit down with Eddie the Chief Clearwater, a great blues legend here in Chicago. So many albums, so many songs. He's got a new project coming up, a new LP that should be out. When should the music
come? Hopefully by the end of this year, by the time we put all the pieces together.
I would be honored to have you back.
All new material.
All new material to talk more with Eddie the Chief Clearwater, a Chicago blues guitar legend. Eddie, appreciate you coming in. Happy birthday again. And,
Thank you.
Thanks for being my guest.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Since you was 9 years old, I want you to come and go with me. I'm gonna show you some soul. I want you to cross over, baby. Get hip to this blues. Gonna play my blues here tonight. I ain't got no time to lose.
Well, it was a good day today, wasn't it? 50 plus degrees. I actually took, I started the day off with my winter jacket, right? Then about halfway through, I graduated to the spring look, you know, so I can get at least one day in. And it was my hoodie that I got for Christmas for my wife. It's the best Christmas present ever. It's a Summit Ice hoodie. If you're not familiar, many people are. I walked around all day today with my chest puffed out, hoping people would see the
brand and go, hey, it's from Nathan for You, the great show on Comedy Central where he creates the winter paraphernalia company, like a ski company. And he's making fun of the companies that give back. I forgot which company he's making fun of.
He found out that his own, the brand that he liked,
yeah,
was owned by like a Nazi sympathizer, yeah, or something. Right. So he had to create his own.
So he created a new brand of outdoor wear, and it was about Holocaust awareness. And so when he did the, and if you're familiar with the show, so it's such a great show. But the he's always marketing new business ideas and trying them out. And in this case, he had in the big end table at the sports outdoor wear store a bunch of Auschwitz stuff with the outdoor wear. If you buy this, then you believe in Holocaust awareness. And of course the stores are like, get this out of here. Like they hated the idea, and he was dejected. But in real life, he actually made it. They're expensive, but he made them, and he made a website. He's like, you can order them if you want, just as a thing. And my wife did for me, and I'm dying to wear it. And now I got a chance today.
Were you wearing that when you ran into the, yes, Bulls, Zach Levine?
Today I ran into Zach Levine was at the cafe in the West Loop. I was going to get a sandwich, quick sandwich. Sat down real quick. Then this kid walks in. I'm like, that kid looks familiar. He looks like he plays above the rim. And it was Zach Levine from the Bulls. And nobody really in the store, no one knew who he was. He doesn't look like, he's 6'4", 6'3", maybe.
Yeah, it could be just a regular
guy.
He just
looked like a regular guy, and I didn't say anything. Actually, somebody just walked up to him. There was one person who walked up to him. And I can't tell you how, like, strangely rude it was. Like, he's sitting there talking to his girlfriend or his wife or whoever it was, or friend, or what, I don't know what's going on. I don't pretend to know what Zach Levine's life is like. And this guy just walks up and was like, hey. And, like, his girl like takes the picture, but he doesn't really ask if he could take it. I got to stay as cool as possible. This fan, I got to stay as cool as possible and show him I'm hard, and he owes this to me. You know, this idea like I'm gonna take this picture with this athlete. He's gonna deal with it, and I'm gonna be as cold as possible. But that's the deal. This is weird. And I came up near them, and I was gonna say my line was gonna be like, "So how you like Chicago so far?" Right? Like,
yeah.
You're new. But his friend was in the middle of talking to him about something, right? It was like two sentences in, and he was listening to her talk about that. I felt I'd be so rude to be like,
can't interrupt.
Not even excuse me, but just like, you're Zach. Like, if I just did that and just interrupted.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, then I would be putting a bad face on Chicago.
Yeah, you
right?
can't do that.
Yeah, that's not what this town is about. We can coexist in a sandwich shop in the West Loop. That's how cool this town is.
It's the kind of stuff they pull in Philly.
Right.
Not
Philly.
Here.
They'd be all over. They'd be trampling all over the privacy of him and his friend having a conversation. But not in Chicago. In Chicago, I walk by.
Did you give a nod, at least?
Didn't even nod. I was more like, this is where celebrities...
Yeah, it's like New York City or
yeah,
Los
celebrities
Angeles.
Hang out, yeah, here, man. Enjoy your avocado toast.
Yeah. Is that what he got to,
no,
to keep his order?
I didn't see what his order was.
I would have tried to peep his order.
It hadn't come out yet. Hey, man. You know, what do I know? It's an industry town. You do whatever you want to do, bro. I do whatever I want to do. Hey, man, it's life. But how cool I get to be in the sandwich shop with Zach Levine today.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, coming up, Patty Vasquez. Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. Stay with us.